Stop.
They have thrilled us with their adventures, amazed us with their discoveries, and inspired us with their courage. We have traveled beside them from one corner of the galaxy to the other. They have been our guides, our protectors, and our friends. Now you are invited to join them for one last adventure. For at the end of history lies
an Alan Smithy film, Burn Hollywood Burn.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and my blog is cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And my name is Andrew, and my blog is thestopbutton.com.
And welcome to the final episode of an Alan Smithy podcast, our little podcast that we've been running for 5 years and, you know, transformed America. It's been almost exactly 5 years. I can't believe it.
Are you sure it hasn't almost been 6 years?
Well, I looked back on this, and the very first episode we recorded was in June 2008. We were talking about John Carpenter.
Yep.
We went through his whole filmography. And it's May of 2014.
Right. Isn't that 6 years? Yeah.
Good Lord. All right.
Yeah.
Well, in other words, it's time to tie this thing off. Because look, people, 6 years ago, there weren't that many movie podcasts. I know it seems hard to believe. I mean, because they're everywhere now. And I guess maybe we got in on the ground floor, but we only ever treated this as just kind of a hobby, you know, just something to do for fun. And we've had a lot of fun with it. But you know, it's really, you can't compete. Even if we became master self-marketers in the podcasting world right now. Two things. Number one, we've only ever talked about the kind of whatever movies we felt like watching, basically, which is why it took us a long time to even decide. It took us like a whole year to even decide on the format of doing double features. And even then, it took us a lot. We were just pairing random movies together. I think it was not until not really until 2011. So we had like a good 2 year period of just doing random movies paired together. And the thing is, you know, like everything else in this world, you got to have a niche, and especially like everything on the internet, you got to have a niche. So we were really not able to capture a niche just doing random whatever the hell movies. And even when we started pairing stuff together, you know, like Revenge of the Nerds 1 and 2 or Alien and Alien 2 on Earth or The Muppet Movie and Muppets from Space. I mean, the only real consistent thing to the Alan Smithy podcast was Andrew and I. And we're not like big enough movie bloggers on our own to garner an audience. Andrew's a lot closer to it than I am because he actually does have like a movie blog that's updated 5 days a week, whereas my movie blog has just been whenever the hell I feel like it, pretty much. So, you know, that's why we decided it was about time to wrap it up. I think in the future it's not out of the realm of possibility that we'll, like, you know, compile a lot of what we think of our best episodes and maybe throw together like some best of Alan Smithy podcast MP3s to download, perhaps on Andrew's site, The Stop Button, or on my site, Cinemachine. But, you know, we'll see. In any case, at this point, we've kind of moved on from it. But boy, you know, we've come a long way, and we've watched a lot of movies. And we're going to talk about all the movies that we've watched, just kind of do, you know, one last little check-in on them. But it's time to start with the movie that gave this podcast its namesake. There was a little movie called Burn Hollywood Burn, an Alan Smithy film, or an Alan Smithy film, Burn Hollywood Burn, or according to the titles of the movie itself, just Burn Hollywood Burn. I think an Alan Smithy film must have been added, you know, at some later point, and it was probably just intended as Burn Hollywood Burn. But, you know, the quick skinny on this movie is that it was Joe Esterhaus, you want to say like, airing his dirty laundry, but as Roger Ebert, you know, our oft-time go-to, you know, lame-oid mainstream reviewer by comparison to us for a lot of these movies we've seen. Ebert makes a pretty salient point in his review of this movie, his, you know, zero stars review, which is actually a fair assessment. It's got the feeling of like an inside joke, but one that isn't funny, one that's like a little too smug and a little too, you know, not wanting to bite the hand that feeds it too much, because, you know, it's all posturing, like the title, you know, like this is going to be this incredibly anti-Hollywood movie. But it was the brainchild of Joe Esterhaus, who was became infamous in the 90s for getting huge paychecks for really trashy scripts and being like this, you know, huge ego in the industry, which is unusual in an industry where the writer gets shat upon. And I don't know, it's like he thought he could make his version of The Player or something, and it's just so asinine and unfunny that it fails on pretty much every conceivable level. And it was directed by Arthur Hiller, but he went with the Alan Smithy pseudonym because he thought that, you know, the studio released Esterhaus's cut of it. And not his, but you really have to wonder if that was planned for the beginning as a lame-ass publicity stunt. It probably was, because, you know, Arthur Hiller just come off of, like, Carpool here with Tom Arnold.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, he really did fall far, even though yeah. The Hospital is one that – I have respect for The Hospital more than I think it's great, and that was sort of one of his big ones from the 70s. And, yeah, so watching the movie – I remember all of the – well, I vaguely remember what a big deal it was that it got trumped up into a very big deal at the time because Joe Esterhaus was such a notable figure. I mean, this was post-Showgirls, so this was his response to people shitting all over him for Showgirls.
Right.
And I don't know. I mean, if we'd done this for the first episode, I don't even know if we could have mustered the enthusiasm to keep going. Because I've never had any interest whatsoever in seeing this, and so I didn't know anything about it. Like, I didn't know it was a mockumentary, and, like, the worst freaking mockumentary you've ever seen, like, made by people who haven't – you're just like, Joe Esterhaus has never seen a documentary.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just – and the edit, oh, God, it just – okay, so it starts with this preview or this scene where they're filming Sylvester Stallone, Whoopi Goldberg, and Jackie Chan in a movie together. And so the idea of the movie is that the studio puts together this movie. Shane Black originally wrote it because, like, that's still a thing. Like, Shane Black was still, like, a guy when this was made. And I'm just like, that really is dated because Shane Black, you know, did, what was it, Long Kiss Goodnight and then didn't make another movie for 9 years. So it's really weird that he's your go-to screenwriter. But it must have been somebody that Joe Esterhaus, you know, liked or something. So, or liked Joe Esterhaus enough to be in this. But then you got Stallone, Whoopi Goldberg, and Jackie Chan in there in what's going to be the biggest movie of all time. And it's just, like, really dumb, like, logic for the way Esterhaus is presenting Hollywood. So, I mean, it's not like...
The premise is that there's a director whose name really is Alan Smithy, and the studio recuts his movie, and he hates it, and he can't take his name off of it because his name really is Alan Smithy. Ha, ha, ha. And so, yeah, he steals apparently the only negative of the movie in the world, thus holding the producers hostage. And he's on the run, he's on the lam, and then nothing happens for a really long time. And then he joins up with some black filmmakers who are like parodies of the Hughes brothers, and they negotiate on his behalf, and then he destroys the movie print anyways, and then the twist happy ending is that suddenly the deals are pouring in for him to have his life story made into a movie, the Alan Smithy story. And it's like – it's an hour and 20 minutes of just excruciatingly – like it's two things. Number one, it's supposed to be a freewheeling satire of Hollywood, but there's like for a supposed or no, for a real Hollywood insider like Joe Esterhaus, there's like no jokes about the sleaziness of Hollywood producers or actors or anything that somebody who isn't a part of the Hollywood system couldn't have come up with. Because they're just like the most broad, like, you know, these people are all sleazy and power hungry and egomaniacal kind of jokes.
And vaguely racist. Don't forget once the vaguely
let's get to that in a few minutes here. But the other thing is that it's kind of like a dumb person making fun of dumb people and dumb things. I mean, not as much as just like the lack of inspiration or incisiveness on making fun of Hollywood. Like, it's not as big a problem as that. But the fake trailer with Whoopi Goldberg, Sylvester Stallone, and Jackie Chan, it's like it's supposed to be a parody of dumb action movie trailers, but it's so dumb that it can't even get that right.
Right. And, I mean, especially in 96, I guess the IMDb trivia says that the original people in the trailer were supposed to be Arnold Schwarzenegger and Bruce Willis, who obviously said no because they had jobs at the time. But it's like Whoopi Goldberg was done. You know, Jackie Chan didn't break out here in Rumble in the Bronx. And Sylvester Stallone was, you know, at a low point again. So you're watching it and it's like it doesn't take that into the humor of that into account. I mean, the only way this movie could possibly work is if somebody had taken it away from Joe Esterhaus and been like, well, this is really shitty. Like, we should make fun of the script while we make the movie. And clearly they can't do that because Joe Esterhaus is in charge of it. So yeah. And there's swearing in this preview. And I'm like, well, that's stupid. Like, I was like that you've already just thrown out any realism to this. So and that's in the first, I don't know, 3 minutes, and the rest of the movie's, you know, just as unoriginally bad.
Yeah, and most of it revolves, I mean, yeah, they make fun of actors, and yeah, they make fun of directors a little bit, but the real point of the movie is to make fun of producers, and the most screen time goes to these two producers who, you know, took Alan Smithy's movie away from him, and they're played by Richard Jenny, who's actually like, who sort of like perseveres in spite of the movie that he's in. No, really. I mean, I think you can sort of imagine Richard Jenny like actually playing a funny, sleazy Hollywood producer in a movie that was actually funny.
You could see that, yeah.
Because he's got that tone of voice. He's, you know, he's got the personality for it. But the other guy who fares even worse than he does is Ryan O'Neill, and it's like Arthur Hiller directing Ryan O'Neill again for the first time since Love Story, right? So
and it's just like, and Ryan O'Neill, I think his problem is he's very contemptuous of it, and it's obvious because since it's a mockumentary, like some of the takes, I'm like, did you guys really want to keep that? Because I think Ryan O'Neill just rolled his eyes at Richard James' line delivery. Like, this is, You can just look at Ryan O'Neill and you can tell that he's sitting there going, what the hell happened to my career? Like,
he's looking at Arthur, remembering better times. You know?
It's just like, do you have any idea how much, you know, how popular I used to be and how I never would do this kind of crappy movie? And I mean, to some extent, let's get the Jackie Chan thing out of the way. Like, they play Jackie Chan as like a spoof of himself. And in theory, it could be people's only exposure to Jackie Chan on film as opposed to, like, a name you'd heard about in 1996. Like, because if you didn't see Rumble in the Bronx or what was the other one? The cop
Super
one.
Cop.
Super Cop. Like, you're like, oh, I've heard of his movies. Oh, he makes fun of the fact that he can't speak English and he's Chinese all the time. That's all he does.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Stallone does this thing where he makes fun of himself, and it's kind of funny because, you know, it's funny for Stallone to be self-aware.
It's not as funny as Stallone making fun of himself in the video that Trey Parker and Matt Stone shot about, you know, what it's like to be a Universal Studios employee, which is really funny if you've never seen it. It's like Stallone, and they get a bunch of other. If you want to see a mockumentary with lots of celebrity cameos that is actually kind of incisively funny, a funny mockery of big Hollywood studio filmmaking, I can't remember what it's called, but you know, you can Google Trey Parker, Matt Stone, Universal Studios film. Sylvester Stallone makes fun of himself a lot better in that one than he does here.
Because he probably had, I mean, I'm sure Joe Esterhaus made him deliver at least, you know, three quarters of the lines in this. And the problem is that, so the way the, when I was saying that it seems like Joe Esterhaus hasn't seen a documentary before is that, so the narrative of the story of Alan Smithy, the director, is, you know, it's like done in these past tense interviews where I guess Joe Esterhaus thought it'd be really cool if, you know, the story progressed from person to person, only it's like they heard the interviewer, who you never really hear, like told them what the other person said, and then it cuts back and forth.
Yeah, like he said what? You know,
yeah,
you know, no way. Just, that's absolutely not true. But the thing that really tips you off to Joe Esterhaus never having seen a documentary or just not, you know, caring enough when he was writing this to make it feel like a Christopher Guest kind of thing is that it'll cut from the interviewees to the same people who are being interviewed, like the way it really happened.
Right.
So there's just no, like, as you said, there's just like no basis in reality whatsoever to it. It's constantly shifting back and forth between, like, you know, a narrative that's actually happening to the mockumentary thing, but with the same people. And there's no, there isn't even a caption like, you know, recreation or recreation using the actual people or something.
Oh, the caption.
Because even that wouldn't make sense. Oh, yeah, and the captioning, right? Basically, in the first 20 minutes or so, whenever new characters are introduced, there's like, you know, a freeze frame and then captions describing, humorously describing people as, you know, whatever, three-time winner, whatever, gives their credentials, and then it also calls them scumbags or sluts or douchebags or whatever.
Or if they're any woman except Whoopi Goldberg, they're identified as a feminist.
Yeah, no, there's a real contempt for women in this, I know, from the writer of Basic Instinct
and
Showgirls.
Who would have thunk it? Yeah, I mean.
And there's also kind of a condescending, racist admiration for black people because they're the ones who come to the character Alan Smithy's aid by, you know, going in to negotiate for him with the studio sleazebags and you know, using their tough blackness to fight for him. Like, you know, fuck you, motherfucker. Alan Smithy wants final cut, you know? And it's a theme in Esterhaus's work because remember in Showgirls, like there's the, you know, Naomi Malone's only friends are like this tough black chick and the black guy with dreadlocks who she has sex with.
It's Chuck D and Coolio playing them, and I mean, I guess they're not as bad as some of the other performers because you can tell.
No,
like,
they're kind of better than a lot of other people
because,
in the movie.
Yeah, I think they probably just came on set and like looked at the script and were like, okay, this will take like 2 minutes. And you know, Coolio looks stoned off his ass, so like,
sure,
he was fine. Like, but yeah, it's this really weird thing, and they don't even fully. I mean, I think that's it wouldn't fix anything in the movie, but
you're kind of it's the closest that the movie ever comes to. It seems like it's about to make some kind of clever point about Hollywood, because it's almost like saying, you know, new popular black filmmakers like the Hughes brothers or Spike Lee don't play by the same rules as these big studio guys, so that's a thing. But then it's just a cheap joke, like, you know, yeah, they're tougher than they are, so they can negotiate for Alan Smithy, and no point is made.
Yeah, I mean, there's, well, what is it? Bullworth was 2 years later with Warren Beatty.
Oh, yeah, Bullworth.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's almost like if they'd done Bullworth 2 years earlier, if they'd done anything with it. But they don't. And I mean, Eric Idle plays Alan Smithy. And I remember when they made this, it took them forever to find anybody to even be in this stupid movie, because it was like a Joe Esterhaus production, and they hired Arthur Hiller late, and like nobody really.
And it's a mockumentary about Hollywood. Sound good, guys, right? Huh? Who wants to sign up for this?
Clearly, Harvey Weinstein, because he shows up in it, and it's Hollywood Picture. Oh no, my favorite is when it's I like started watching it, and it, the Synergy logo, and I don't know if anybody remembers anymore because they've been out of business since about this time. They did a bunch of action movies back then, big time action movies. Like, didn't Carolico become Synergy or something?
I don't know.
But they put together the money for stuff like Die Hard 3, and so when there's the action shots or the explosions in the trailer for the other thing about this movie stole is it's not just the most expensive movie ever made, it's also like the best reviewed R-rated blockbuster ever made,
right?
And so all the explosion shots are from Die Hard 3, and I'm just kind of like, oh, well, they don't even make a joke about that. That should be part of the joke. And they couldn't even... you mentioned it earlier about how he can't take his name off of it. And something that's really missing for this is there's nobody from the Directors Guild saying why he can't take his name off of this. Like, that needed to be there. Whenever it came up, he was always like, but I can't. My name's Alan Smithy. And it's like,
yeah, all you get is a pre-credits title card just saying, oh, by the way, the Directors Guild pseudonym for directors who want to take their name off the movie is Alan Smithy. And if your name is Alan Smithy, then you're fucked. Haha. And here's a movie about it.
I mean,
and oh, another cameo, you know, supposed self-parody cameo that doesn't quite pan out is Robert Evans, he was kind of having his, you know, comeback right about now because this was about the time that his autobio, The Kid Stays in the Picture, had just come out. And yeah. It's like all these people playing. Yeah, oh man, there's really nothing worse than like seeing somebody trying to make fun of themselves and failing at it. And this movie's just a marathon of it, except not even because they could barely get anybody to be in it. But it feels like what they're trying to channel almost is the Larry Sanders Show, which is like, you know, that the HBO series of the fake late night talk show where Gary Shandling plays a Johnny Carson type. And that was a great, amazing show. And pretty much every episode has like actors and musicians and people making fun of themselves really well because the script's like really funny and always walking that fine line between, you know, mocking them and also, but not degrading them. So,
right. I mean, if you can get, what was it? I think it's the last episode to date of Curb Your Enthusiasm. If you can get Michael J. Fox in there making fun of the idea that he uses Parkinson's to get shit in life, like the fact that Joe Esterhaus couldn't get anybody to do anything good.
Well, it's like Joe Esterhaus apparently didn't even want to get Joe Esterhaus. I mean, that would have been the real reason to do this movie is if it was like about Joe Esterhaus playing himself. Running off with the print of a movie because of dispute with the studio. Like, it's about you, Joe. Like, why don't you, you know, just make it literally, you should have made it literally about you. You should have starred in it.
Instead of poor
paycheck cashing Eric Idle.
Yeah. Going when they were like, we really wanted John Cleese, but this guy was in Monty Python, right? There's this one point where Richard Jenny's talking about all the directors they could have gotten, and they bring up Stuart Baird, who at this point had maybe only made Executive Decision. Yeah, that would have come out in 95, I think, right? And, you know, that was like a pretty decent-sized hit for what it was, and everybody was like, oh, who's this Stuart Baird guy? He was this editor who might have been editing back till like the Superman days. And the Alan Smithy character is an editor who they give this directing job to because they think they can control him. Well, of course, the joke is that Joe Esterhaus apparently couldn't foresee is that that's like what Stuart Baird's known for, is being like the studio's whipping boy director, like, because his next movie was U.S. Marshals and, you know, that sucked and everybody was like, oh, it's the end of Stuart Baird, and it kind of was. Then he went back to editing. So it's just poorly... where's Paul Verhoeven? shouldn't he have had something to say about this? And no, because he knew it was even.
That would have. Yeah.
Yeah.
It could have used a nice Paul Verhoeven cameo where he's saying, like, you know, well, you know, you have these shitty scripts, you can still make. Well, but people didn't know in 1997 that, you know, Showgirls was the classic that it was going to become. But, you know, speaking of Paul Verhoeven, it's like Basic Instinct was this huge mainstream hit because it was this really trashy thing and you know, Verhoeven directed it really well and people just went to see it and enjoyed it as this really trashy thing. But with Showgirls, it's like just as dumb and trashy, but like that time around, Verhoeven was just like embracing that even more to the point of absurdity, but people didn't have a sense of humor about it, so they just all thought it was this really bad movie. And it's, you know, at the very least, it's so bad it's good. It's like, you know, over the top and like gloriously so. I don't think that's how Esterhaus intended it to be, but yeah, like you said, he makes this movie in response to people shitting all over him because of Showgirls, and there's even a line in the movie, you know, which is a real clunker, like all the other funny lines where Richard Jenny goes, I mean, this movie was bad. It was worse than Showgirls. So it's like, does Esterhaus really think that Showgirls was a bad movie? And if so, does he think that it's because of how Verhoeven directed it? And if, you know, I guess so, because, like, otherwise, yeah, he might have had a Verhoeven cameo with Verhoeven talking about, like, you know, how to direct a bad script into a hit. That would have helped somewhat.
Well, I mean, I'm just trying to think of. Okay, so they're the producers. There's a lot with the agents. And what it also feels like, so this was 96, 97. Oh, this was 97. So, yeah, Stuart Baird was probably already a punchline by this point. But it came after Get Shorty, which really repopularized the make fun of Hollywood type of thing. And that was 95 or 90. I think it was 95. Because The Big Picture wasn't a hit, which was Christopher Guest's attempt at doing something about breaking into Hollywood. So, you know, it's clear that Esterhaus thinks he can use a certain amount of vocabulary about Hollywood and people will get it. But my favorite's, what's-his-face's agent, Eric Idle, is Alan Smithy's agent, who's, you know, got this long, he's got long hair, he's got Dennis Miller hair, only nicer, you know. And, yeah. He's identified as a scumbag, liar, you know, douchebag, whatever. And then the guy's like, all right. Like, the worst thing he wants to do is, like, re-sign Alan Smithy at the end of the movie or something. Or he, like, hides him for a second when he's on the run. Like, the guy's totally fine. And that's when I was thinking, so did Arthur Hiller go, yeah, I probably don't want my name on this thing that's, like, making fun of Janet Maslin. Like, that's really mean. Like, it's...
Oh, yeah.
If you're making... If it was such a big deal to Siskel and Ebert that Roland Emmerich and Dean Devlin shit all over him and Godzilla, like, this is just, like, you know, Janet Maslin's, like, you know, hyper-obese and, like, talking about how... You know, whatever she does is going to be great because
it's not a Janet Maslin playing herself.
No, it's not. It's like, you know, and the character's name is something like Manet Jaslin or something. Like, it's just, it's really subtle, you know. And she probably said, "Hell, you know, it's another." And I'm sure in one of her reviews of a Joe Esterhaus movie, she was like, "Oh, it's another shitty Joe Esterhaus script." And it's like, it is. All of Joe Esterhaus's scripts are shitty. All of them. I mean, yeah, I mean, Basic Instinct's a beautiful freaking movie because, you know, Paul Verhoeven got, he didn't just get good editors, good photography. He also, like, took the time to do amazing special effects that didn't need to be there for, like, what, you know, 30, 45 seconds of screen time. He had, That awesome
Rob Bottin
thing, and it's just like that's why it worked is because of that amount of care for the project, and it's just like apparently Joe Esterhaus thought it was because of him, like
yeah, and everybody else did too. I mean, boy, And you talk about not understanding the hierarchy of creative input here. This is a Burn Hollywood Burn is a movie complaining that the director gets no respect, but it's the statement from a writer who feels like, yeah, right. That the only time, because the Janet Maslin, Manet Jaslin character is the one who wrote this movie, right? That's been kidnapped by Alan Smithy, and it's supposed to be so great. So is that it's like Esterhaus doesn't even know what statements he's trying to make. So he's saying that, like, you know, the writer is crucial to the success of a movie or the quality of it. It isn't. It's like the only thing he knows, the only statement he can make in this movie is that he doesn't like producers. And he can't really make fun of them that well because he's not that smart. And because, well, I don't know if because of this, but it's like they made him who he is. They're the ones who, you know, because of their shitty taste, made him rich off of these god-awful scripts. Most of, you know, and by the end of his career, and this movie really was the end of his career, you know, it's like the one good thing to have come out of it. He wrote slightly more flops than hits. I mean, it's pretty much just comes down to like Flashdance and Basic Instinct, and all the rest did like middling to nothing. And Showgirls was a huge bomb, and this was a huge bomb. And that was it for him and Arthur Hiller.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Arthur Hiller did direct National Lampoon's Pucked a little over 10 years later. So
did Arthur Hiller direct The Stupids? I can't remember.
no.
There, yeah. Speaking of Joe Esterhaus, the only other thing is in '97 he also did. Well, I've never seen Telling Lies in America, and that was supposedly his, you know, like a good movie attempt at like doing a good movie. But I haven't seen it. He apparently got paid $4 million to do, like a treatment. It sounds like for One Night Stand, which Mike Figgis did as his follow-up to Leaving Las Vegas with Wesley Snipes and Robert Downey Jr. and Natasha Kinski. And I love that movie. Like I just watched it. I mean, not a few years ago, but I mean, I love it. And he had his name taken off of it because he's like, that's not my movie. Like, that's not my great idea. And it was like, no, it was actually good. Because Mike Figgis can occasionally do good things when he's not trying to be experimental. But yeah, when you look at, okay, let's get off Esterhaus for a second, because I did want to say that doing like an Alan Smithy biopic sounds like a fun idea, on the other hand. Like, if you actually had to do a biopic of somebody.
Like that Peter Jackson mockumentary about this great pioneering silent filmmaker who never actually existed, Forgotten Silver.
Right. Like, with Alan Smithy, the movies are so weird, you could work out some sort of narrative for it, and it'd be cool. Like, because it would go from big stuff at the beginning to TV by the end. And it would have a, you know, natural petering out of a career, and it'd be kind of interesting. And you could do funny stuff because you would interview the people who are involved with the actual movies. And I don't know why Joe Esterhaus chose Alan Smithy as the thing to center his, you know, rant around. A rant around how, oh no, everybody in Hollywood's racist except me, and
yeah,
and it's just like, I don't know, and it might be some of
this is a movie. This is a movie attacking producers for messing with a director and thus all creative people's integrity of vision. But what if your vision is really shitty?
Well,
that's like a point that he can't address because he's Joe Esterhaus.
But the other thing he can't address is that so he worked with a producer who used to be thought of as not shitty and quite good, you know, Robert Evans, right? He worked with Robert Evans at Paramount on Sliver and Jade, and they both sucked. So even having a good producer or someone who used to be a good producer doesn't really matter. And yeah, it's like Well, what about an action movie where the producer really does pull it together? Because there are tons of those. I mean, you know, box cutter, cookie cutter action movies are not really. I mean, they have nine screenwriters anyway, and so did some of his movies. And it's just, there's no.
You know, it's a good box cutter action movie, though. United 93.
Yeah, there you go. Wow.
I'm sorry.
Wow, you went there. Wow.
All right. Well, I mean, what else is there to say about an Alan Smithy film, Burn Hollywood Burn?
Ever.
Well, it was, you know, I guess if nothing else, this movie was the inspiration of the title for our podcast, because that particular phrase, an Alan Smithy film, stuck in my head. And, you know, if an Alan Smithy podcast seemed to make sense when I suggested it to you.
Yeah. That's another thing, is it took us forever to come up, and now we're switching gears into the retrospective, everyone. It took us forever to come up with the title, I remember. It took us a while, because back when we started this, yeah, there weren't, like, if you had a movie podcast, it would be called something like The Movie Podcast or something
like
that.
And this is, yeah. And this is part of the problem of, yeah, not having a specific theme for a movie podcast, you know. There's this million zillion horror movie podcasts on the internet because, you know, there's a lot of nerds on the internet who like horror movies. And if you've got a horror movie podcast, you know, it's probably not too hard to come up with a catchy title, but, you know, a title for a podcast where you just talk about whatever movies you feel like. I mean,
yeah,
and the thing too was, like, you know, you had your blog, I had my blog, and it's like we couldn't call it either the Cinema Machine podcast or the Stop Button podcast. I think at one point I actually suggested that to you because I figured, like, well, you know, you're way more prolific on your movie blog than I am with mine. We should just, you know, switch it over. I think if we ever do come back with a movie podcast again, we should have it be the Stop Button podcast. But
when we started, I still was not trying to do daily stuff, and you were still fairly regular. I mean, you were posting probably as much as I was back when we started, or if not as much, about half as much. Like, you were doing weekly at that point, I feel like. Yeah.
Yeah. And incidentally, I mean, I've got the domain name registered for, you know, just MatthewHurwitz.com, and I am going to be moving my movie writings over there and trying to get serious about that again. And that's, you know, part of the reason that I'm, you know, we decided to kind of cut this thing off to devote time to other things. But, you know, mommy and daddy still love you very much.
It's been the whole podcasting thing has changed so much from when we started
six years. Famous people weren't really doing podcasts 6 years ago.
You know, stand-up comics weren't doing podcasts to, like,
movie podcasts. You didn't have Doug Loves Movies or you know, the Flop House or anything. It was like, yeah, just kind of open terrain.
What's funny is that the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab podcast just celebrated their 500th episode, I think, today. This afternoon, we're recording this Sunday, May 4th, and it'll probably be up tomorrow. But they were, you know, whenever I needed technical ideas, those would be the guys that I went to. So I thought it was kind of funny that, you know, and they're an incredibly commercially successful podcast for what they are. And of course, we never really took this above the hobby level, just because. You know, yeah, it's the Alan Smithy podcast. I mean, if you knew anything about film, you'd think we were only going to talk about Alan Smithy movies. Like, it's just.
Yeah, which would have been insane. But I think we got like four Alan Smithy movies into the catalog over time.
On that note, should we start the grade?
Yeah, what the hell? Because I don't know how long this is going to take.
I think we should go backwards.
You think so? Okay.
I think we should go backwards because I don't – I know where we would end if we go backwards, and I don't want to end with Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park in Detroit. Well, I really don't want to end with Detroit Rock City. So.
All right. Well, we just talked about that in the last episode. But
so,
Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park. It's really cheesy, and it's not even so bad. It's funny.
Right.
You should
There's
just
nobody
probably skip
interesting
that.
In it. Skip it. Detroit Rock City. Hey, it ties into this one because there's like weird sexism in it, and a little bit of racism too.
Yeah, a little bit of anti-disco Guido prejudice.
Yeah, and the only good thing that'll come out of that is that if you haven't listened to that episode. I cut in some quotes from role models that I've been sharing with people, and they've really enjoyed the breaking down of Kiss's music. But anyway,
yeah. Manhunter Red Dragon. This one was for Philip, really.
It was for Philip,
our number one fan. Hi, Philip. Because yeah, we had just been thinking about it forever. Good pair of movies to put together. Two adaptations of Thomas Harris's Red Dragon. I forgot. Well, I never really realized that Manhunter was as good a movie as it was, and Red Dragon was even lamer than I remembered when I saw it, like as a teenager.
Okay. Yeah. Let's do a little bit of commentary on if it was something that we hadn't seen before. A little bit of appreciation. For example, The Fly and The Fly 2. I'd never seen The Fly, and while I have my issues with how it goes narratively, you know, Cronenberg is a fantastic filmmaker, and you can really see that in The Fly, and. You know, this podcast, since Matt does a lot of horror, and I think that was one of the really cool things about this podcast that I don't think you can really easily describe, is that you, at least when we started, were sort of coming in from more of a horror angle.
Yeah, I was coming in from the typical internet film critic, but fan of exploitation movies.
Right, and I don't really have that, and so I was coming from it with some quirks, but mostly from like a very, you know.
Well, you've always been the classy one.
Okay, except with for my Jaws 3 review that I
yeah, except that you gave 2.5 stars to Jaws 3D recently.
Okay, but so it really let me. It really helped me. Branch out into things that I wouldn't necessarily have branched out into before. And then we'll get to that with Texas Chainsaw. But yeah, so The Fly, Fly 2 is a piece of shit. Skip that. But The Fly's awesome.
Yeah. Arthur and Arthur 2 on the Rocks. Okay, so like here's something that was from your pool of knowledge that I like, you know, made myself get around to through this podcast was seeing Arthur, which you know was a big hit back in the day, but is kind of forgotten now and shouldn't be because it's it holds up really well and it's really funny and it's a movie from a classier era of filmmaking. And like an era of, you know, funny comedies for adults. It's kind of, you know, like from the Woody Allen type of inspired golden age of comedies for grown-ups.
Yeah, and nothing that Matt just said about that applies to Arthur 2 on the Rocks.
Which is, as you pointed out, from the era of Warner Brothers being like, hey, we got a million Police Academy sequels. Let's make sequels to some other comedies we own the rights to. Okay, so... Before that, we talked about Island of Lost Souls and Dr. Moreau. You just put up your Island of Lost Souls.
I did. I just put it up today.
Written review on the stop button. And Island of Dr. Moreau, the one, the John Frankenheimer one, it wasn't as bad as like I thought it was going to be, but it's pretty dang lame. And I don't know. Marlon Brando wearing pancake makeup. What can he say? Invisible Man.
Invisible Men. Yes, we did Invisible Man, and then Memoirs of Invisible Man.
Yeah.
Which I guess is, at this point, it's the last John Carpenter for an Alan Smithy podcast. And we've been doing this for so long, we were hoping he'd start making movies again. And that was a cool one because Invisible Man is sort of forgotten. And it's really awesome,
Even by the classic monster movie crowd, because it's not, you know, Invisible Man isn't exactly a monster, is he? I mean, you know, it's more like a science fiction movie, but the science fiction isn't played that heavily into it, but like it's got this fantastic concept behind it. But as you put up the written review for this also just recently, it's mostly just an amazing, you know, character study of this guy who's going mad because of this fantastic thing that's happening to him. And Memoirs of an Invisible Man, yeah, it's really lame, but I have a feeling the novel on which it's based is probably pretty good, because it must have been pretty good for like it to have been such a high profile movie at the time.
Yeah. And then of course, Beware the Blob and the Blob remake from 1988, but the kitten, the cute kitten at the beginning.
Yeah,
the say the cute kitten. There
you go. I'm still whistling the theme to Beware of the Blob to this day. So I'll give it that. Otherwise, it's just really terrible dreck. And the Blob 88 is I can't recommend that one, unfortunately, because even though it's got great gross special effects, that's kind of all it has going for it.
And then we here's one that I'm very glad we did. We did Donnie Darko and S. Darko, and it gave me a chance to re-examine Donnie Darko, which I had only ever seen the very extended director's cut, which includes a bunch of, I suppose, probably CGI'd in title cards doing weird things with the narrative, with the...
Yeah, and I still haven't seen the director's cut to this day. We watched the theatrical cut, and I've always really liked the theatrical cut, and that's the only version of it for me as far as I know. I kind of don't want to see the director's cut and have it ruined for me, and I still really like this movie, and it's, it means a lot to a lot of people, I think, for a reason. It's actually like a very kind of touching coming-of-age story with all these, Philip K. Dickian sci-fi overtones to it. And then S. Darko is like a movie you can hardly believe that exists. Like, what? They made a direct-to-video sequel to Donnie Darko about his sister, and it was kind of just as bad as I was hoping for. Like, as a, just a lame copy of Donnie Darko and being like, oh, Donnie Darko had an 80s movie, 80s soundtrack, so Donna, S. Darko is going to have a 90s movie soundtrack to it, and so on and so forth.
It would have been so much better if she, at some point they had called her Stephanie and she'd be like, call me Donna.
Well, the reason I called it Donna just now is because when I was in high school, my friends and I made a parody trailer for the corny sequel to Donnie Darko, where it's like a She's All That type of teen movie.
Which would have been awesome compared to S. Darko.
Oh, so Repo Man and Repo Chick.
Yeah.
Repo Man's a movie that's been real close to my heart for a long time. And that was one of those episodes where we just talked about how great the movie is, like pretty much breathlessly, nonstop.
Yeah. And Repo Man, it was another one that gave me another chance to go back and see it because I hadn't seen it in a long time. And I don't think I'd ever seen it widescreen before. And And then
Repo Chick is this weird, like, shot entirely in front of a
green screen type thing, but it's like, it was pretty cool.
And it's Alex.
Yeah.
And
it's still Alex Cox. Yeah. So you got to pay attention.
You got to give it a shot. But you kind of would have. I think I would have been warmer to it if they hadn't called it Repo Chick and they had just be its own thing a bit more. Okay, we did a commentary on Return of the Living Dead, and it wasn't even the first fucking time we talked about Return of the Living Dead.
It was a return to the Return of Living Dead, which
the reason is that it's my favorite movie I've decided in recent years. Period. And so that's just one where it's just 90 minutes of me gabbing nonstop about how awesome it is. And Matt Lohr, the guy who helped posthumously complete and publish Dan O'Bannon's book on screenwriting, was like nice enough to link that on his Facebook recently. So I know he's
cool.
heard
wow.
some of it. Yeah. So, that was – and he and his wife Diane – or Dan O'Bannon's wife Diane like gave me an advanced copy of that book to review for Cinemachine because I got to meet them somewhere. So that was kind of how that came about. So that one's worth watch or worth listening to. Caddyshack and Caddyshack 2.
Yeah.
Caddyshack is a classic comedy, and
Caddyshack 2 is close to my heart, quite unfortunately. And so I finally made you sit through that, which was interesting. To go back to that again after, so many years.
Dread.
The Dread
episode.
Yeah.
This is, like, I had just I think I was watching – I think I saw Judge Dredd for the first time for that episode. And I had just seen Dredd. And, you know, the highest praise that – I don't know if I said this in the episode itself, but the highest praise I can give Dredd as a comic book movie is that it's a comic book movie that got me into the comic books. Which should be like the aim of any comic book movie.
Yeah.
As like a gateway to everything that, you know, that it was based upon. And Dredd's great. The internet doesn't need to be told that at this point.
Right.
And Judge Dredd is really awful.
Dredd is actually, even though, like you said, yeah, I mean, the internet has – what I don't know if you read, but Carl Urban was somewhere and he's like, actually, Alex Garland's writing the script just in case. For Dredd too.
Yeah,
he's like cut to a bunch of
internet nerds jacking off, and
exactly.
then cut to the producer of Dredd going like, look, it's nowhere near even beginning to start happening, so relax.
Start sending me cash. But Dredd is right now the one movie that it's like, if I have guests and I'm like, hey, have you seen Dredd? Let's put Dredd on because, you know, you need to see this. And then before that, we did The Last Temptation of Christ and the Passover plot, which was
one of our really clever concept episodes because we had it like come out around Passover / Easter. And, you know, it's about the death of Christ and the resurrection and the Passover plot was this obscure TV movie about how the resurrection might have been faked, and
it's shocking that one didn't put us on the map, you know, like really.
Oh right,
yeah,
you know, the religious community. Last Temptation was like better than I remember. That's a really cool movie and very controversial in its day, kind of forgotten now, but worth going back to and checking out if you're so inclined. Red Planet, Mission to Mars.
Well, we did discover Mission to Mars has a lot of good things in it. That is true.
Mission to Mars is kind of like one that you're expecting to be bad, and then it's like just kind of mediocre. Red Planet, though, was something I was expecting to be mediocre, and it just turned out to be really, really bad.
And I told this anecdote in the episode, but Red Planet losing money on that is what drove me from the Hollywood Stock Exchange, HSX.com, I believe, which is still there. Too, which is frightening to me that this still exists, and it would make Joe Esterhaus happy.
And we were almost going to combine all.
Oh yeah, remember that we were going to do
Invaders before that we did Invaders from Mars, the original from the 50s, and then the Toby Hooper Canon Films remake.
We did do two episodes in 1 month with that. Yeah, we actually.
It was March Madness, right?
But we were actually going to do three. We're going to do
And then we were also going to do what, Devil Woman from Mars or something?
Robinson Crusoe on Mars. But yeah, Invaders from Mars and Invaders from Mars, those are pretty cool. And I mean,
this is the kind of thing where I think in the future when we go back and cut up the audio all over again and like put together some best of specials, that can all be one collective episode, just one super long discussion of Mars movies.
This was a good one.
Before that, we got pretty good at, you know, combining movies for themes, like when we actually put our minds to it, because we did St. Valentine's Day Massacre, this, you know, movie that Roger Corman did for 20th Century Fox in the late 60s, which is really cool, and it was a bomb then. It's forgotten now, but it's like got a great cast and a good script and everything. And then we followed up with Some Like It Hot because it's loose. The beginning of Some Like It Hot kind of is loosely inspired by the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. You've got these two musicians on the run who are at this, you know, shooting, which is supposed to be like, I don't think they ever mention it by name, but it's the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Anyways, that's just kind of an excuse for me to get you to see St. Valentine's Day Massacre,
which
it's
was
cool
awesome
movie.
because it was when I was rediscovering Corman, because the episode before that was Little Shop of Horrors and Please Don't Eat My Mother, which you'd been trying to get us to watch forever.
Right. Well, Little Shop of Horrors, you know,
Little Shop of Horrors.
I love the '80s musical, and I love the original one. And Please Don't Eat My Mother, I just needed an excuse to see. It's like, I know there's a pornographic 70s parody of, you know, Little Shop of Horrors. How can I justify taking the time to watch that to myself? And it was kind of like just as bad as I was hoping it would be. and really sleazy and everything. So before that, we did Fletch and Fletch Lives. Pretty simple, you know, a movie and its sequel kind of episode. And I talk a lot at length, I think, in that episode with my like high school fascination with Fletch and how hyped I was for the idea that Kevin Smith was going to reboot it and that never happened. And then Fletch Lives was like a good opportunity to talk about that bad Warner Brothers comedy sequel syndrome.
Of the late 80s, yeah. And then before that, we did another Carpenter. We did Halloween, but we did the extended TV cut so I could bitch and moan about the added scenes.
Right.
And then the day after Halloween. Well, yeah.
Yeah. Which is not the original title of this bad movie.
This bad Australian movie, yeah.
Which is supposed to be like an erotic thriller, and it's not erotic, and it's not thrilling, and there's like one murder, and it happens in the last 10 minutes of the movie or something, and you would never confuse it with a sequel to... So that was disappointing, because I was expecting like an unofficial kind of, you know, a fake cash-in sequel to Halloween, and it wasn't.
Oh.
So speaking of different edits of things, prior to that we had
Godzilla King of Monsters,
which is the Americanized version with all the Raymond Burr scenes cut in, and I wasn't expecting them to be as badly cut in as they are. It's a real, if you're an aspiring editor, it's a good lesson in what like how not to do it, what not to do, because it's very awkward the way Raymond Burr is cut into this Japanese movie. And then Godzilla 98, was it?
Yeah, 98.
Which was I'd never seen. It was worse than I was expecting. So
yeah,
that was painful.
Before that, speaking of painful.
Speaking of even worse than I was expecting, well, Blues Brothers 2000, and we watched Blues Brothers also. And yeah, Blues Brothers 2000 is abysmal, and you know, I think everybody knows that. But Blues Brothers, I liked that episode because I got to talk about how overrated I think that movie is.
Yeah.
I kind of just dump on John Landis's disregard for human life a little bit.
Again, because we do that a lot, actually. I mean, even though I wouldn't say either of us really like John Landis, I think he's shown up on here quite a bit.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Prior to that, we had Barbarella and Galaxina.
Oh.
And Barbarella's really bad. And Galaxina was like bad, but not in the way that I was expecting it to be. I was expecting it to be much more of like a softcore porn flick. What's her face? You know, Galaxina doesn't get naked once in the whole movie. It's kind of baffling.
And in Barbarella, that's how it opens. So you would think that if you were going to do, I imagine there were a lot of angry people in the theater at Galaxina.
Dorothy Van Stratton was her name, right?
Yeah.
And we realized that we missed the chance to have a better themed episode by doing Galaxina and Star 80, which is based around her real life murder. Prior to that, we had I Married a Witch, I Married a Witch was like better than I was hoping it would be. It's Veronica Lake, and Bewitched was worse than I was expecting.
I remember that one because you wanted to do a rant on Will Ferrell and his
That episode gave me an excuse to talk about.
But you didn't get to really do it though because he doesn't do that in that movie.
Oh yeah, he's not playing his usual, you know, pompous idiot character in Bewitched. He's like more the straight man. So yeah. At least we watched I Married a Witch.
Right.
That's a great movie. Oh, and Criterion re-released it recently, which is cool.
I saw that, yeah.
Prior to that, we had the original Brian De Palma Carrie, which was awesome.
Yep.
And The Rage Carrie 2, which was
awesome.
Super lame in a very 90s way, very late 90s kind of way. But it's probably better than the Carrie remake that just came out recently.
I
think at least its lameness was more interesting than the recent Carrie remake with Hit Girl. Prior to that, we did a commentary. See, we kind of dabbled with the idea of doing commentaries occasionally. We did a commentary on Supergirl, which apparently is one of our more downloaded episodes, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
Supergirl fans are just starving out there for any kind of attention.
Any kind of recognition that this movie existed. So, yeah. And I remember we had this long talk about it because I desperately wanted to do a commentary on what was it, the theatrical version, but we had to go with the most readily available one.
Mm-hmm.
That one was interesting. We sort of between the commentaries, we sort of went between totally absurd things to do commentaries of and then, you know, the expected thing to do commentaries of. So in some ways, yeah. Supergirl is kind of in between. It's not the craziest commentary we did, but it's also not the most.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so prior to that, we had a Real Genius, which is, I don't know if it's cult. I don't know. It doesn't really matter like how much people remember it or not, because it wasn't a hit in its day. But it found its cult audience, yeah. And maybe its cult audience has kind of wavered a little bit. But whatever, people will always, you know, it'll always be around for people to discover. It's a funny little movie, and My Science Project is just a total obscurity, which. You know, between that and I think Super Mario Brothers, the movie, which I rewatched recently with the Riff Tracks commentary, which was very funny. It really made me realize how much I disliked Fisher Stevens. Oh, also, Fisher Stevens also plays a really unfunny Indian scientist character in Short Circuit 1 and 2, I think. So,
yeah.
My Science Project, my hatred of Fisher Stevens is my title for My Science Project. Prior to that, commentary on Mannequin 2 on the Move, and that was fun because that's just, you know, speaking of Riff Track, speaking of like Mystery Science Theater, I mean, it's so easy to make fun of.
Right.
That movie.
What an absurd thing to do a commentary of, and I think that was what we were going for with that one. But then before that, speaking of absurd, we actually watched The Man Who Knew Too Little, which is coming out on Blu-ray, which is frightening.
Yeah, Bill Murray's The Man Who Knew Too Little. This was from the last gasp of Bill Murray trying to do wacky comedy roles before Wes Anderson made him an indie darling. and The Man Who Knew Too Much, which is just a good, solid Alfred Hitchcock movie.
Yeah, and we didn't actually do that much Hitchcock, if you think about it, just because, you know, it wasn't quirky enough.
What would have been the point, really?
Right, exactly.
Prior to that, speaking of quirky,
we had Silent Night, Deadly Night Part 2. Yeah.
Made you watch. You should be thanking me for Garbage Day.
I think actually YouTube might have taken down our clips of Garbage Day commentary finally, but yeah, that was a fun one.
Yeah. That's a great so bad it's hilarious movie that has, you know, found its audience now because of that isolated clip of the guy going Garbage Day, and you know, people then saw the movie and they were like, wow, the whole rest of the movie is just as insanely stupid as that moment. This is great. And also it's like a greatest hits compilation of clips from Silent Night, Deadly Night, so it's like two movies in one. Prior to that, speaking of sequels, we did Poltergeist and Poltergeist 2, yep. And I think we probably spent most of our time talking about, you know, well, how can you tell if it's Toby Hooper or Steven Spielberg directing this? And Poltergeist, and with Poltergeist 2, is just kind of an anatomy of a bad sequel type of discussion, because it's like, yeah, obviously it was like obviously something that was very easy to make a sequel to, but that doesn't mean you should, and whatever, you got some H.R. Giger designed tequila worm monsters to keep you happy. So whatever. As far as the chronology of these episodes, by the way, I mean, from about the time that we started doing like thoughtfully paired together movies, you know, which was like now, which is around this time, I should say, we were churning out, well, right about now we're getting to the point where I think we were committed to doing like two episodes a month, or at least like, you know, every other week. But from Man Who Knew Too Much and Too Little on to now, we kept it to one per month, which so it kind of like slowed down to a crawl over time. But yeah, Muppets – well – Poltergeist and Poltergeist 2 and Silent Night, Deadly Night both came out in December of 2011. Night, Deadly Night 2, obviously being a Christmas special of sorts. Muppet movie, the Muppets we also did in December of 2011. So we got three episodes out that month. And Muppet movie was just, you know, it's a great movie. What can you say? Muppets from Space is like, you know, whatever. But I don't know. It's probably got a little more zip to it than Muppets Most Wanted, which like the title alone kind of makes me not want to see it ever, regardless of it being a Muppets film.
Prior to that, Cool World and Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which led me to rediscover Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and Bob Hoskins did just die.
Right.
But then Cool World, which sucks even worse than I remembered it. Yeah.
Yeah, which is really bad, but at least it's like an interesting kind of bad because it's a high concept bad. It's a high concept studio bad movie where it's like, let's get the director of Fritz the Cat to direct a adult version of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, but oh wait, we don't actually have the balls to make an adult version of Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Let's keep it PG-13 out there, Ralph. So that was a good episode. It was good stuff to talk about.
Here comes the
Mae West episode.
Mae West episode.
We watched She Done Him Wrong, which is, not a great movie, and you were much more down on it than I was even prepared to be. Incidentally, I recently read a couple of plays by Mae West that she wrote back when she was like, this saucy lass of Broadway before she got a movie contract. And like, they're very, they're incredibly risque, as you might imagine, but, also kind of smart and funny and everything. And, she was a real talent. She Done Him Wrong is not her best work, but, Sextet is definitely not her best work. But I can't help but like Sextet a little bit just because it's such a prime slice of 70s disaster where it's just like, there's nothing here. This movie shouldn't have been made. Let's just cram it with cameos. It's got that Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band kind of vibe to it, the one with the Bee Gees.
Yeah.
As far as being a train wreck.
Another thing we should mention is that at some point before we decided on thematic pairings or sequels or anything like that, it was supposed to be one good movie, one bad movie.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, and
I forgot.
Yeah. So I think
this looks like it might have been our last good movie, bad movie pairing, right?
Yeah. Well,
I guess Roger Rabbit and Cool. No, even Muppets from Space. You know what? I guess what was it? When did we really change it up here?
I mean, so the Blues Brothers 2000, we knew they both were going to be shit.
I guess we always tried to keep it to one good movie, one bad movie, but we put more effort into pairing them together in ways that made sense.
Right. So,
sometimes the gulf was wider than not. In the previous episode, it was pretty wide because we did Black Book, speaking of Paul Verhoeven.
Paul Verhoeven's comeback, and
Blood Rain, the Third Reich, both of which have nothing in common except that they're set in Nazi Germany. And, I don't know what to say. It's pretty self-evident. One's a great movie. The other's a Blood Rain sequel. I mentioned fake sequels earlier that we watched Alien, just the original classic Alien, and then a cheesy Italian cash-in sequel called Alien 2 on Earth, which I really might have to go with as the worst movie we've ever watched on this because it's just boring. It's just not even bad enough to be funny. It's just nothing happens in Alien 2 on Earth. And
yeah.
I thought it would be better than that because some little startup, exploitation re-releasing video company put it out on Blu-ray, and I thought, oh, there must be something there. But there really wasn't.
We had a Tim Burton episode. We had Mars Attacks, and we had Sleepy Hollow.
A good opportunity. a perfect opportunity to talk about what went wrong with Tim Burton's career because I think we both agree that Mars Attacks was his last great movie, and Sleepy Hollow was the beginning of the end. So that's a good episode just to watch, for a lot of commentary on Tim Burton and the trajectory of his career. And another episode to listen to if you want to hear us rag on John Landis was the one we did before that, where we just talked about Twilight Zone the movie. And there wasn't a second movie because we just figured, we've got four segments here, four different directors.
And we probably spent half the episode talking about John Landis killing people.
I wanted to do that one because I had just read Outrageous Conduct, which was a book about the Twilight Zone case, which is really good. So that was a good one. Before that, we did Revenge of the Nerds 1 and 2, Revenge of the Nerds, you know, it's like the Caddyshack episode, you know, classic comedy followed up by a bad cash-in sequel. Although, unlike Caddyshack 2, I think you pretty much hated Revenge of the Nerds 2 as much as I did.
And it's also kind of a different... Just to go on a teeny tangent, it's a different thing because we did a lot of those Warner Brothers sequels, I think, unintentionally. But the Revenge of the Nerds sequels, almost more like the Porky's sequels. Like, just a very strange, you know, thing that we discovered here doing Alan Smithy was that the way different studios try to exploit their brands is very different. But before that, yeah, oh God. All right. We did Breathless and then we did Breathless. We did the Godard and then we did the remake and oh God. Yeah.
The remake, which I'm sure, you know, five people out there know even exists. But in 1983, there was a remake of Breathless with Richard Gere and it's pretty dang lame. And, then we had Escape from New York. That was another Breathless praise kind of episode, followed by 2019, After the Fall of New York, which, unlike Alien 2 on Earth, is a Italian ripoff sequel that's actually enjoyable to watch because it's not boring. It's like really silly and wacky and is close enough in resemblance to what it's ripping off that that you can kind of enjoy what a ripoff it is. Prior to that, we did a lot of comedies and their, you know, poorly
regarded
comedy sequels because we did Airplane and Airplane 2. And that was interesting because Airplane 2 isn't awful. It's just kind of mediocre.
Right.
So it was like a good comparison piece. I love that before that we had, and I'm just going to pat myself on the back here. This was our 1980 King Features Syndicate episode.
Yes.
Between Flash Gordon and Popeye. Those were both comic strip movies based on properties owned by King Features Syndicate. And
that was the first time I saw Popeye. Yeah, and
And I'm a proponent of that one, if only because it's not a great movie, but I feel like it gets shat on more than it deserves to.
Whereas,
I mean, it's Robert Altman doing a musical, you know,
right.
If nothing else.
And Flash Gordon, so we did this one in December. Yeah, we did it in December of 2010. So that's before Ted. So it's kind of I don't know if Ted actually led to people thinking that Flash Gordon was okay.
I think people always remember Flash Gordon as being better than it is,
right?
Because of the Queen music.
Right.
And because of the
and we talk about that at length. But yeah, so I don't think Flash Gordon's and then when we did that one, was that right after it came out with that classy Alex Ross re-release cover? And it's it's just a piece of crap. Like, come on, knock it off. Yeah.
Not if you were like 6-year-old Alex Ross in 1980.
I don't know. Six is a little old for that. I think I was probably 4 the first time I saw it, and it's been convincing me for years that it's okay. So, I don't know,
yeah.
6, I'd hope I was in better shape. But then before that, we did an American Werewolf in London and an American Werewolf in...
Yeah, the start of the John Landis obsession, I guess. And
But that was an interesting one for us because neither of us are huge Rick Baker fans. So here we take...
Right, it gave us an excuse. It gave us an excuse
to talk about the Howling.
The Howling makeup was better, or whatever.
Rob Bottin, second time this episode. Okay,
right.
An American Werewolf in Paris, which is a astoundingly poorly executed sequel.
Quasi, not really. Sequel.
With terrible CGI that you think.
Yeah,
would,
really bad
yeah.
90s CGI. Sure. So then, yeah.
Then
speaking of bad sequels, prior to that, I, you know, and speaking of horror, I got you to see... You hadn't seen...
I hadn't seen Texas Chainsaw, yeah. So you finally got me to see Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and I said it in the episode, and I'll say it again. I watched it in the middle of the... Like at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a sunny day, and it still creeped the livid fuck out of me like it did the first time I tried watching it. And then Return of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which...
Better known as Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation. Better known as the one with Renee Zellweger and Matthew McConaughey.
I don't know. Should we watch Dazed and Confused instead? Because, yeah.
Well, I feel like Vilmer was largely the inspiration for Rust Cole. And if you like to think of, you know, True Detective as a prequel to Texas Chainsaw Next Generation, I can, you know, I've written a fanfic, which actually bridges the gap between the two continuities. Anyways, okay, so that was, but that episode was the beginning of actually
pairing
together.
It was
because prior to that, yeah, we've got this what the fuck of Please Teach Me English. This is when we were getting into South Korean movies.
Yeah.
Or when we had been for a while. Please Teach Me English, which is a decent South Korean comedy, and Zardoz,
yeah. And Zardoz, man. And
I don't think I hadn't seen it before, and I got to admit, I kind of liked it. It's sort of become a guilty pleasure for me. Not that I've rewatched it since then, but I do sort of remember it fondly for being as, you know, weird as it is. I admire any movie that, you know, has the courage of its own weirdness, and Zardoz really does in spades.
Yeah. And then before
Sweet
that,
Bird of Youth.
Yeah, Sweet Bird of Youth and Bats, yeah.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping Sweet Bird of Youth would be better than it would be because it's based on or it was written by Tennessee Williams, but it wasn't very good. And then Bats is
really awful. I barely remember anything about it
really,
except that it's
really,
really bad. Yeah.
Really forgettably doesn't really do it as a killer animal movie.
And then, Far Cry and Conduct Zero. And,
yeah, Far Cry is a Uwe Boll movie, and I can barely remember what it's about. It's some island where genetic super soldiers are being created or something.
With Till Schweiger, the German guy. But for a while, yeah, there's a terrible pop song in it, and I think for like at least two episodes, I tried mixing that in as our theme music before I went over to the music from each individual thing, movie, which I think became easier once we started doing stuff.
I'll take this opportunity to pat you on the back for doing the editing on all these episodes because, you made it easier for me not having to think about that. And
yeah, but
you
had to write the – you had to write all. You wrote rather lengthy things. Yeah.
You know, this is another thing though, where it's like I knew that this thing was on its way out because I really did write fairly lengthy descriptions of the movies for all the postings on our website. But I right around the time where we started doing one episode a month, starting in like 2013. I didn't have it in me anymore. I think when did I really stop doing that? Maybe it wasn't like a whole, all the way back in the beginning of 2013, but I think it was right around the time of Island of Lost Souls, Dr. Moreau. So really we're talking about just the last like five or six episodes or so. Invisible Man, Memoirs of Invisible Man might have been the last time I put any effort at all into doing the write-up.
I can see why that would depress you. But another thing with the editing is – And I guess we can tell everybody now, yeah, our Skype connection sucks. So after 30 minutes, it cuts us out and we have to figure it out. We have to go back and, yeah. Mm-hmm, so if you're ever listening and going, hey, that's kind of disjointed or something sounds differently. Yeah, it's because Skype cuts out and we've never been able to figure it out in 4 years or 6 years of having the problem. But it used to be worse, actually.
Yeah. Do you remember anything about Conduct Zero, the other movie in the Far Cry episode? Because I really don't.
Conduct Zero. Wasn't that the one – I feel like –
I think it's South Korean.
You'd seen – and it – yeah. You'd already seen this one because you'd gotten a bunch of Korean movies. It was the school one with kind of like the bully and the girl – the best fighter – at Monduck High. I actually remember. Yeah, I mean, I kind of remember it. He, and there's a girl, but it's like, it's sort of like a coming of age thing, but not like forced at all. Yeah. You actually recommended this. We actually
I'm looking at the poster now and I do remember it, but whatever. I remember now that it was good, but I just don't remember anything about it.
Oh, and then, okay. Yeah.
We had a fucking Piranha kick. I mean, this is like another one where we can go back and cut together a whole Piranha special because prior to this, we did Piranha, the Joe Dante original movie. We did Piranha 95, which is like a remade for Showtime version of it, but it's so cheap because it's Roger Corman right. that they actually reused the Piranha footage from the original.
But then, yeah.
And we did Piranha 2, but we'll get to that. Okay, so prior to that, we did an Alan
Smithy,
episode.
Yeah, episode 50.
The first Alan Smithy credited movie, Death of a Gunfighter, which is a decent Western from like 62 with Richard Widmark, I think.
Yeah,
and Birds actually... 2, which is a made for Showtime sequel to The Birds, which was actually directed by Rick Rosenthal of Halloween 2 fame.
Yeah. Birds 2 really sucked, and Death of the Gunfighter was fine, yeah. But I mean, tying back to the beginning of it, it'd be very interesting to see the arc of a career that started with a perfectly
with
decent
Death of a Gunfighter and it ended with Burn Hollywood Burn. And we didn't even mention that earlier. That was they retired the Alan Smithy pseudonym after Burn Hollywood Burn.
They thought too many people would know who it is, and I'm kind of like, yeah, I don't think so. I think that, name recognition on somebody like Ridley Scott's probably, 38%? Like, if you're not Steven Spielberg or somebody else, nobody really actually knows your name. Like, who do you know the name of the people who directed what? The guys who directed Captain America 2, do you think we could I think Alan Smithy was fine. I think they just did it because they hadn't done a theatrical Alan Smithy in many years. So we did Blackmail Is My Life, which was a Japanese movie you wanted to check out, and then we did Dr. Giggles.
Yeah, and Blackmail Is My Life is a really cool 60s kind of poppy, peppy, but also noir, and it gets real dark at the end. Crime movie with some, black humor in it. And Dr. Giggles is, who doesn't know Dr. Giggles, right?
I think we both talked about how we were aware of this movie because of the ads and comic books,
I think it had a huge advertising budget for some reason.
Or they got a really good deal from comic books.
Yeah, and the ads, we noticed the ads in comic books as kids, and I was young enough that the ads actually scared me.
And then before that, we...
we were kind of carrying over a Larry Drake theme because we watched the Darkman trilogy, in which Larry Drake plays the villain Durant in all three of them, or the first two anyways. That's a good special.
Yeah.
I don't remember anything about Darkman 2, but what I remember about Darkman 3 is that I kind of like Jeff Fahey as the bad guy. Anyways, Killing of a Chinese Bookie and Less Than Zero preceded that. Killing of a Chinese Bookie is good, but I mean, it's not really my kind of movie is what I realized. I'm not like smart enough for John Cassavetes movies, or I'm not in tune enough with humanity, but Less Than Zero is the product of Bret Easton Ellis, and that's a guy who's really not in tune with humanity, or he's in tune with the worst aspects of humanity. But it's a much lamer movie than The Rules of Attraction or American Psycho, as far as just movies about eighties yuppie assholes.
For the one, I think this might be the only time. But for Killing of a Chinese Bookie, you watched the theatrical version, and I watched the.
Oh, that's right.
Extended version, yeah. And so I'm talking about stuff, and you're like, I don't remember that. And I was like, I really wish I didn't remember it either because mine was too long by 20 minutes. And then before that, we did The Dark Half and Day of the Dead. We did a Romero episode.
We were kind of dabbling in the themes.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the list here. Dark Half was super lame. And Day of the Dead's a great zombie movie. And I mean, the only thing I can add to that now, which I'm probably repeating myself from this episode, but it's even better kind of if you look at it in the context of it was going to be George Romero's last zombie movie. Like, that was just him putting the cap on it. It's even better viewed through that lens, and it's quite good on its own merits, but it's been sort of diluted by the fact that Romero kept making zombie movies after that. But what can you do?
Yeah.
And speaking of horror, prior to that, I'm such a fucking horror dork. Look at this shit that I managed to get you to watch. We watched Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare.
I don't think I would have argued about this very much because I said it back then, is I saw this in the theater. Inexplicably, for some reason, I felt the need to see the last Freddy movie in the theater when I probably hadn't seen any of the other ones, but it was just that I could actually...
You got to put on the 3D glasses.
Put on the 3D glasses at the end, and I assume it was just because I could get into the theater at the time. Like, I was finally of that age where somehow I had figured out the way to get into an R-rated movie pretty easily. Yeah. And then New Nightmare.
And then there's New Nightmare, which as Dylan in Afterlife with Archie so rightly points out, is one of the only two Freddy sequels you can take seriously, along with Dream Warriors. Okay, so prior to that, and speaking of comic books, we did Watchmen, The Ultimate Cut, which is Watchmen, the worst possible cut with the dumb animated, pirates, comics, sequences spliced in.
Yeah, and so I feel like this
That was a really long episode.
It was a real, and we just bitched and attacked if you ever want to hear people just crap on the Watchmen, if you just. All over Zack Snyder, which is hilarious. Given
the only reason we would ever have to go back to that or update it or anything would be that at that time the Before Watchmen comics hadn't come out. So, by way of comparison, I mean, and by the way, a lot of the Before Watchmen comics were not bad. Some of them were really bad, but some of them were actually all right.
Yeah.
So it's not like there aren't people out there besides Alan Moore who get Watchmen. They just weren't. Zack Snyder,
Net. So I don't know. Oh, well, they're both from 1995. Maybe that's why. Had you seen Dead Man before this?
I had not, and it was really good.
Yeah, so, I mean, I that's one of those ones I like revisiting. And then The Net, I actually saw in the theater. And so coming back to it, I don't know, what is this, 15 years later, it was really shitty, really. And it was actually surprising because I expected a better level of mainstream competence from 1995. I remember that.
Well, my favorite thing about The Net is that, like, in the first 20 minutes – I almost called her Sandra Bernhardt. I think it's because she was in Burn Hollywood Burn. Mm-hmm. Sarah, what's her face?
Sandra Bullock.
Sandra Bullock. Orders a pizza on the internet, and that was the near future. And today you can order a pizza on the internet, and you can even track its progress in real time on its way to your front door. So how awesome. What a prescient movie The Net was.
There you go.
Prior to that, we had Black Narcissus and Cobra. Here's a real, left field kind of thing.
We were really going for bad movie, good movie with this one because
you've got Powell and Pressburger, lushness and greatness,
and then Cobra,
Stallone, just the nadir of Stallone's any cheesy 80s action movie.
Shit, we did Django and Cash too. We're gonna come back to that. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but Cobra, just to compare it real quick, is more enjoyable for its badness than Tango and Cash
yes,
is.
Cobra, yeah, because Cobra's got Brigitte Nielsen. It's got Stallone cutting a pizza with a huge knife. White supremacist. What else?
It's got an inexplicable cult, death cult as the villains. And the action sequences aren't even that bad, actually.
Yeah.
Okay. But
and then a Batman commentary.
That, I think was this our first attempt at a commentary?
No, we did Halloween 2 time before. But yeah, we did Batman, and I feel like I don't know if anybody requested this, but we felt like we kind of wanted to get around to doing a Batman commentary just because I don't know.
I guess it was, because we were riding the wave of hatred for our Dark Knight episode, and we were like, how can we cash in on this? How can we capitalize on
that our
most popular episode is our most unpopular episode?
Yeah,
because
all of our shitty comments on iTunes to this day are still about, either the fact that I apparently said I wanted to watch movies letterboxed, or that we didn't like The Dark Knight, which was like episode 6. But yeah, I mean, and the other thing is that I think if you want to look at the themes in these 100 episodes, it's that people have forgotten the importance of the 1989 Batman in terms of how it affected mainstream
Well, I guess three things, really. mainstream, big mainstream franchise launching movies.
Okay.
Movies based on intellectual property that were primarily popular with nerds, kind of like the mainstreaming of nerd culture.
Nerd culture, yes.
And, you know, to that extent, comic book movies,
right,
which were still not really a thing, you know, even 10 years after Superman. So that's, you know, we talk about that in the commentary. It's besides just praising the movie for being really good.
And then before here we go.
Yeah. Right, the other Piranha movie. We talked about Robert Altman's Gosford Park.
And then we paired it with Piranha 2, right, because those two go together. Yeah.
I think in Gosford Park they eat fish at some point, or probably.
And of course we did this Gosford Park commentary before Downton Abbey, so we really missed out on cashing in on that, which is sort of the subtitle of an Alan Smithy podcast. We missed out by probably three months on everything.
Missing the boat for 6 years. okay, so speaking of sequels,
Psycho 2,
Psycho 2 and Psycho 98. And you know what's funny is, like, we talked about Psycho 2. I was, like, very up on it. I think because I hadn't seen it a long time, I was giving it high praise. And I would still give it high praise today, but now that, like, since Shout Factory came out with the Blu-rays of that and 3, I've come to realize that, like, Psycho 2 is really a mixed bag. It's a mixed bag that I have a lot of affection for, but boy, is the plot absurd. And it's only really the direction and the acting and, you know, some of the dialogue that kind of makes it work. But the premise is so absurd. They let Norman Bates out of the asylum and they let him stay at his old house where he committed murders. Excuse me?
This one's also interesting because we never
did. You know what happened later on was Riff Trax did Psycho 2, and I watched their version of it, and they pointed out how silly it was. And I was like, oh man, Riff Trax, you made me enjoy this movie a little less.
I think Psycho 2 was one of the that was a good Jerry Goldsmith score. I feel like at this time I was really on my
Jerry Goldsmith score.
But then obviously this didn't show up on the podcast, but I then watched Psycho 3, and we talked about that at length, which I did write up for the stop button. But this got me, you got me to see Psycho 3 based on this. And, of course, Psycho is now, what is it, Steven Soderbergh released his cutting together of the two, which I've been meaning to watch but have not gotten around to, the original and the remake.
Oh, yeah, 98,
yeah.
Yeah, and Psycho 98 is – I'll say this. If it were not released wide to theaters across America, if it were only available to see in a museum that you had to pay an admission to see and you could only see it in one place, I feel like the context would be different enough that even though it sucks, you would still have – like people would have some kind of admiration for it, like as an experimental film.
As an experimental film, yeah, I think you really could – and that's an interesting idea.
Make a case for its validity, but as like as something that for entertainment value, it sucks.
Right. Yeah. There's a lack of creativity to the concept that a change in venue and a really restricted one. I can see that.
Yeah.
But so, then before that, we did another Veronica Lake. We did This Gun for Hire, and we paired that with Congo because apparently I wanted to punish you for something.
This Gun for Hire is a really great noir movie, yeah. And Congo, this is like one of these 90s blockbusters that I just, you know, flat out chose to miss out on and came back to through an Alan Smithy podcast. And Yeah, it's pretty bad, all right.
I actually got an email about Congo. Somebody emailed and was the stop button and was asking me why I didn't have a post for it. And it was some guy who was like, I really liked it as a kid, but I think it sucks now. Like, did you ever write about this? I'm like, no, but you can listen to this episode. Like, what's up? It's a piece of shit.
Okay, so Mean Streets, good movie, Martin Scorsese. Nothing more needs to be said about that. Showdown Little Tokyo. We managed to fit a few of these, you know, really bad action buddy action movies or just, you know, vanity role action movies into the catalog of episodes here. And as far as those go, Showdown Little Tokyo isn't that bad. I remember it being sort of cheesy enough to be entertaining.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know,
Tia Carrere's nude body double is pretty hot. You know, what are you going to do?
There's a ton of action too. So I mean, it's like, you know.
Oh, right. It's not like one of these action movies that, you know, fails to have action in it. Yeah. So it was all right. Before that, another really random pairing of movies. The public domain noir classic, The Stranger, with Orson Welles and Edward G. Robinson, where Welles is like a Nazi on the run and Edward G. Robinson is the guy who figures him out. And it's good. I don't remember anything in particular about it. Jay and Silent Bob Strike. The real reason to listen to that episode is that I think we do a good job shitting on Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back right afterwards.
And Kevin Smith really never got a lot of attention from us on Alan Smithy, even though...
No, so that was like our dumping on the career of Kevin Smith episode.
And then before that, we actually did the RoboCop trilogy, which was... I remember we talked about it for a long time, because it might have been our first trilogy.
Yeah, it was our first trilogy episode and our first sort of themed episode, I think.
And I think we started talking about RoboCop, well, not as early as I guess I would have thought. But
RoboCop has been another long time theme in this episode's podcast's life. It's just the go-to, you know, one of those unsulliable, you know, perfect hallmarks of geek entertainment.
And then the discussion of 2 and 3, and I think we talk a little bit because at that time we just discovered the original like concept for 3, right, with the Jackie Chan version of the ninja or something. And I'll take this moment now. Have you read RoboCop: The Last Stand yet?
No.
Okay, so I'm holding in
but
my.
It's an adaptation of the original Frank Miller script, right, for RoboCop 2 and 3, except didn't they already do that?
No, it's only an adaptation of 3, and that's sort of confusing to me, but because if you read the RoboCop 2 script adaptation, there's a lot from RoboCop 3 in it, and so I think for the third one, they took a lot of stuff from what they didn't use in 2.
It's so confusing. I don't know where the line cyborgs eat bullets was originally supposed to be.
but RoboCop Last Stand from Boom Studios, and at least the first trade is out right now, even though it's got a 2 on it. It's also part 1. I'm very confused about this. But it's got art by this guy named Corkut Ozkit. I'm mispronouncing his name. He's a nice guy. I talked to him for a second on email once. He's like a Polish kind of punk artist. And so they finally figured out how to make a good RoboCop comic. And even more than that, they finally figured out how to make RoboCop 3 good. So check out RoboCop The Last Stand. Hopefully they'll put it out in a nice hardcover. The art's beautiful stuff, too. And then... That's all.
Oh, and look, well, there's one more thing you got to say. I think it's worth mentioning in the final wrap up here. You got an email from the director of RoboCop 3, didn't you?
Oh, I did. My claim to fame is that any Fred Decker post I make gets a response from him. That's probably why I've never seen Night of the Creeps, because I don't want to get a response from him. I guess
it was actually like in response to your stop button review.
It was in
Robo
response
3.
To my response.
That precipitate us doing a RoboCop trilogy episode?
Probably. I'm a shallow, shallow person. I think I asked him to get interviewed by us, and he turned me down and said that he didn't want to subject himself to character assassination. And that was before we had read that he wanted to use the Japanese android like Jackie Chan. The benefit of the doubt was there. Yeah, that might have been it. Yeah. Well,
okay,
let's move on.
Speaking of the Japanese, we did Kira Kurosawa's Hidden Fortress before that, which is a really cool movie.
Yep.
And 2010, which I guess later on we might have paired this with the original 2001, but it's the lame sequel, 1984 sequel to 2001, and it's mostly just boring, but with some really nice special effects for the space stuff.
I feel like during this period, it was kind of like, hey, I want to see this movie. Why don't we pair it with another one? And so, yeah, before that, here we go. We had Return of the Living Dead paired with The Last Boy Scout.
Oh, yeah. And The Last Boy Scout was written by Shane Black, right?
Burn, Hollywood, Burn. We're just tying back to that.
Last Boy Scout's horrendous, and it's got a lot of that trademark, action screenwriter misogyny to it. And Return of the Living Dead, this was another time for breathless praise. So it might be interesting to compare my breathless praise in that episode to the breathless praise in the commentary. But by the time we did the commentary episode, I had read the Dan O'Bannon screenwriting book, so I could sort of look at it from a more informed perspective on like the structure of the story and everything, how intricate it is. Prior to that,
we did Metropolitan,
our one and only Whit Stillman movie, and
I had a lot of trouble getting you to watch that too. I remember that. I was like really
pushing
for
Whit. Yeah.
I was really pushing, and then we paired it with Of Unknown Origin, which is do two George P. Cosmatos movies? That's kind of surprising.
Yeah, this
is
Cobra.
I'm going to make this promise now.
Four Peter Weller movies.
I'm going to make this.
No, wait. Two. Three.
Wait.
Make a promise.
RoboCop. Okay, my promise is for the website and at AlanSmithyPodcast.com, I'm actually going to update it somehow. I haven't decided. I just made this up in my head, that it'd be cool to see the pairings, because we really did not plan on doing Cobra when we did Of Unknown Origin. The connections between these movies are very organic. I mean, they're not premeditated at all. I don't know how the
Sometimes there would be connections. I mean, I think we got to the point where we were like looking for some kind of connection.
Right.
That we could only figure out by watching the two movies, and sometimes it was really a stretch. And we never agreed that that was going to be something that we had to do for every episode, but I guess we felt like we had to justify it to ourselves. The previous episode to that, Cops and Robertsons and Barton Fink. I don't know what those two have in common. Nope.
No. Yeah, that was a good one because it sort of reminded me to hate Chevy Chase more than I think I'd been doing at the time. And that, the Coens, I don't know if we ever talk about them at length. I think this is about the only Coen movie we did, right?
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, we both have great regard for the Coens, and it's kind of weird that it's just not something we talked about. And I think with Alan Smithy, we tried to veer away from the standards. I think we
tried to pick movies that haven't been talked about much, whether be they good movies or bad movies.
And I think actually the episode before that's a perfect example, because it was Slapshot and Cruising.
Yeah, and Slapshot has its cult, but it's a very tiny little cult.
And I don't know that they're necessarily as online as they could be.
It's because they're all like sports fan dads who don't use the internet much. Slapshot's cult audience. And biggest Chris... Slapshot fan in America right now is drinking beer in Milwaukee in a basement somewhere.
And the biggest and actually, cruising fan in America is James Franco.
Well, I mean, hell, Slapshot and Cruising, I'm not sure which one was intended to be the good movie, bad movie. Okay, well, like, I know Cruising was supposed to be the bad one, but I think I enjoyed Cruising more than I enjoyed Slapshot, if only for the soundtrack, which is, like, fucking just disco punk heaven, you know? Cruising, bad movie, great soundtrack.
Okay, yeah, Cruising.
And also worth seeing just for the how the fuck did this get made. Oh, there's another popular movie podcast that really started tearing it up in the 6 years since we started doing this. How did this get made?
Exactly.
Paul
Scheer,
I think.
And I think I refused to listen to it because I'm like, oh, fuck that. Like, we should have been doing that. Yeah. Yeah.
I think a lot of movies we watched for Alan Smithy podcast were how the fuck did this get made kind of movies.
Well, The Beach.
Like, you know, sex.
Yeah.
Like this or Sex Ted or The Beach, which was the previous episode.
The Bank
which we
Dick
paired
and The
the
Beach.
Bank
yeah.
Dick. Yeah. So that was just, you know, appreciating some W.C. Fields and then The Beach. What the fuck? How did this get made? Leonardo DiCaprio, you know, hipster dream of being on a beach with just like, you know, you're not living a life like an Outback Steakhouse commercial or something, and then it gets a little bit, and then predictably it gets a little Lord of the Flies by the end. But it was, I don't know. It was made by the guy who made some other stuff.
Danny Boyle. It was Danny Boyle. Danny Boyle
exactly.
Shit out his career and then had to reinvent himself.
Right.
Yeah. And then before that, we did The Stepfather, which I'd never seen but had always heard about because I was familiar with Joseph Rubin. And Hellraiser Bloodline. And I'll never forget this because Hellraiser Bloodline is what, number four?
It's the fourth one.
And
yeah,
I had to watch the first three. Yeah, I watched the first three, yeah.
I didn't realize that got you to watch the first three, saying the fourth one for the podcast. Because your Hellraiser reviews were actually in the print collections, I remember, of Stop Button. Stopped Buttons, 4 years.
Yeah.
769 films, and yeah, you can get Andrew's movie reviews in book form. People pick up Stopped Buttons because
Stopped Buttons
it's got
would be the most fun one, I think, because it's the most ranting. Yeah, as opposed to.
But I love when you call Hellbound Hellraiser 2 like Tron in Hell. It's like perfect description for why I enjoy it.
I think with that one, I was like, hey, do I actually need to watch Hellraiser 1 through 3 to? Because that was our first Alan Smithy. That was
right.
Yeah,
right.
I was like,
it was actually directed by Kevin Yeager, but he went with Alan Smithy.
He went with Alan Smithy, and I was like, "Do I actually need to watch Hellraiser 1 through 3 to understand this?" And you were like, "Yeah, probably." So I sat down and watched all the Hellraisers. I think over like a weekend, maybe, and I was just like, "Why the hell was I scared of these as a kid?" Like. You know, the third one, it was like, hey, we're going to make action figures. And the first one, I was like, this is supposed to be scary? What is Clive Barker thinking?
Yeah,
like,
part two is the only halfway decent one. But anyways.
Oh, well, God. I just saw what's next. It's the next two.
Because speaking of, horror sequels and such, we watched Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge, the gay one. And this was before that.
This was
before the documentary where they actually cleared up that, like, yes, some of the people who made the movie were aware of what they were doing with the homosexual subtext. So I think if you go back and listen to our episode, it's pretty much just a what the hell were they thinking? Was this intentional kind of episode?
I'm going to tell an incredibly politically incorrect, make an incredibly politically incorrect remark right now.
Yeah, go for it, dude.
I think Bryan Singer should remake Freddy's Revenge at this point.
That would be awesome.
That would be awesome. And we also we paired that with Night of the Demon, which is a 1957 Jacques Tourneur sort of investigative horror movie with Dane Andrews set in the UK. It's really good shit.
It's like a You know, it's like a Val Lewton produced horror movie, except you actually get like money shots of a monster.
Right.
It's not just all implied. So it's even better. Prior to that, we had Antonioni's Blow Up, which I just can't. This is why I'm not a classy guy. I can't get into these like slow, ponderous, existential 60s new wave art movies. I didn't quite care for Blow Up.
But you also didn't quite care for Harley Davidson the Marlboro Man, did you? No, that one was pretty freaking awful.
And the only thing I can remember about Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man is that it's a near future movie.
It is a near future movie, yeah. And they go to Las Vegas, yeah.
It's like 10 years in the future, and I don't know. There's like some very. It's not exactly Demolition Man in terms of being a satirical depiction of future Los Angeles, but it makes one or two stabs at it.
Yeah.
Okay, so prior to that, we had the awesome Paul Schrader movie Blue Collar with like Harvey Keitel and Richard Pryor and Yaphet Kotto, and that's really awesome. And the not so awesome Oliver Stone movie, The Hand.
Which
where
was
Michael
nowhere...
Caine is terrorized by his severed appendage, and
it's not as amusing as it should have been, as I recall. Yeah.
Well, because it takes itself pretty damn seriously, but it's not quite enough of a technical failure to even be amusing on that level. It's mostly just really boring and forgettable, unfortunately. A not so boring or unforgettable bad movie though that we reviewed earlier that month, and by the way, we were averaging about 3 episodes a month.
I think by this point,
we
initially shot for an episode a week, which is kind of crazy when you think about that. We were both still blogging; you were still pretty active at this point.
Yeah, so... I was also unemployed, so that kind of changed the
game. Yeah, we should have been looking at my period of unemployment to see if that affected how many podcasts we did. But yeah, we really
Funny how that works.
Yeah, it's amazing how much time you have when you don't have a job. But yeah, so we did Caligula, which I remember you had to talk me into. And then another thing about the podcast going for 6 years is that, well, 5 years when we were doing these pairings, is it was sometimes a pain in the ass to find these movies. Like, some of these movies, we found them on, like, Region 2 DVD, which barely exists as a thing anymore. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, I remember it was a pain in the ass to decide on a version of Caligula because... at that time, there'd only been like one release and it had gone out of print in a month or something. And so we paired that with Hour of the Wolf, which was a Bergman that.
Which was kind of cool. It was,
that one. I liked that one. It was
psychological,
it was
existential angst movie.
Yeah. And Caligula was like 3 fucking boring hours. And,
well. I think Caligula, though, is part of that. Like, if there's a canon of bad movies that people should look to as, like, the worst movies, Caligula's in it. So it's got some kind. It's got some kind of distinction to it.
And then before that, do you see what's here?
Well, before that, we watched a very different type of bad movie, which is sort of the bad movie that's like too hard to watch, at least for me, because it's not a bad studio movie is very different from a bad indie movie,
right.
And especially a bad indie genre movie. Like, well, the Polonia brothers are these guys who have like churned out seemingly dozens of bad direct-to-video horror movies, but I mean they're like high eight bad like direct-to-video. I mean. Like this, we're talking zero budget here,
right.
And it's kind of unwatchable. Bad Magic. I don't remember anything about it.
No,
and
I think it was about voodoo, and we paired it with Yojimbo of all things.
Yeah,
yeah.
I didn't even remember that we'd watched 2 Kurosawa movies, but Yojimbo's really good.
Yeah.
And then prior to that, we did our first commentary, as you recalled. It was Halloween 2.
Which might still be up on YouTube in 8 different parts. Not sure how that happened, but you might be able to check that out. That was fun because, we hadn't really done John Carpenter, and so we just sort of got to crap on Halloween 2 without much lead-in, yeah.
Yeah, well, we had earlier, but we'll get to that. Wages of Fear and Talk Radio. Talk Radio was a good movie to make fun of because it's so like histrionic and self-righteous and dumb.
And I still remember your comment from your friend about Talk Radio.
And what was that?
Wasn't it something like your friend got done watching it and he turned to you and he was like, wait, they killed him because he was a Jew?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Peter Bogdasanian or something. Anyways, yeah, it's an Oliver Stone scripted movie. He directed it also, but yeah, it ain't
Wages
that good.
Wages of Fear is good.
I noticed that you reviewed Sorcerer.
I did,
recently,
yeah.
For Stop Button, and apparently it wasn't that bad, huh?
You know what? It's really well made in parts, and that makes up for the friedkinisms, I guess I'd say. But I mean, the really good parts are. They're enough to push it through, and then the silliness in the third act is a problem. But it's one of those, and we never
would
really,
have been a really obvious pairing if we had cared about pairings.
But we never would have done it because Sorcerer didn't come out original aspect ratio, which that asshat on. Our iTunes comments. Yeah, by the way, this is the last episode. You know, I got in a fight about The Dark Knight from some guy who left us a shitty review on iTunes, and I know who it is. I got in a fight with the guy on Twitter that apparently was so early in Twitter that, like, a friend of mine came up to me and was like, dude, what did you say to that guy? And I was just like, hey, like, I'm sorry. Like, it's just a Batman movie. Sorry. But I don't even know where we were. But, yeah, let's go back before that because Rooftops is a piece of shit from Robert Wise, but you finally got me to watch Matinee. And Joe Dante is somebody who's really underrepresented on Alan Smithy, even though we both love him to pieces.
Yeah. And Matinee has still not gotten its due.
No.
It's came out in 93, and it's a magical out-Spielberging Spielberg kind of movie about like the wonder of childhood, and specifically the wonder of being a budding, you know, monster movie fan in the kind of William Castle era of monster movies. It's set in the Florida Keys during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and John Goodman plays this lovable William Castle type exploitation movie promoter, and it's Joe Dante doing his best, you know, comedy, but he also works really well with kids, and he also does like this, you know, making fun of cheesy monster movies stuff that he does so well in other movies, and it's like all the best aspects of Joe Dante's, you know, talent in one movie. I'm glad you finally saw that. Prior to that, we had Blood Rain 2, Deliverance. I can't believe we saw two Blood Rain movies.
We watched three Uwe Boll movies for the podcast, and we always wanted to watch another one. It's really weird. We watched Blood Rain 2, and I remember absolutely nothing about it whatsoever. Wait, no, it's set in the Wild West, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Well, thank you for reminding me.
The one thing that pops out of me is that there's one really tasteless scene where a bunch of children are held hostages with nooses around their neck, and the villain is like threatening to hang them all simultaneously. That's all I remember because I was just like such bad taste.
Let's not forget, of course, that Uwe Boll, and that's a flip because I actually respect him for when he killed all those kids in Postal. But anyway, all right.
Okay. Emperor Jones. We talked about.
Yeah, we talked about that because we were checking out Paul Robeson.
A little Paul Robeson obscurity. Good movie. Pre-Code, I think it might be. Very interesting movie about race and from the early 30s in its own way. Tango and Cash, which you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, shitty buddy action picks. I don't even know how this one would have figured in unless we were like, Kurt Russell kick for a second.
I think we just figured it would be a easy enough bad movie to make fun of.
And then we did California Split.
Yeah, I guess the two movies are both buddy comedies in their own way. Because
yeah.
California Split is like, what, Elliot Gould and another guy?
George Segal, yeah. You didn't like that one that much, I remember. I really liked it. It was Altman.
I'd probably
like
it.
Eh.
I'd probably like it more if I went back to it now. Okay, so prior to that, we...
John Carpenter.
Yeah, we watched Elvis, and I don't think either of us had seen it before.
No. Yeah.
Yeah, so that was kind of a treat, and it's Elvis. It's not bad at all, really. I think it finally got a proper DVD release of some kind or Blu-ray release recently from Shout Factory, of course. And it's Kurt Russell in an Elvis biopic, and it's not bad. And then Resurrection of Bronco Billy, the Academy Award-winning short film that Carpenter directed at USC, and you know that's not really great, but it's interesting. Just you know, if you're a Carpenter fan, prior to that,
Funland. Oh yeah.
Funland.
Explain Funland, everyone.
Funland is a lame attempt at a black comedy about a depressed, neurotic clown. Who gets fired from his job and at an amusement park. And the only really interesting thing about Funland is that, number one, it has a sequence worth watching on YouTube in which the clown hallucinates that the employees at the cafeteria are rapping about hamburgers and hot dogs. If only the rest of the movie were so amusing. But the people who released this movie had such little faith in it that on the video box they made it look like a horror movie, and it's actually kind of a scary cover because it's got this really demonic-looking clown with a machine gun. And the movie is nothing like that. And we paired that with Asako and Ruby Shoes.
Our first South Korean movie, and I think I was just in the mood to watch that again, which... That's been an interesting thing because we tried picking up on different themes through the podcast, and it's just kind of like – it's like every time we pick the wrong one. I don't know.
Yeah.
Now that we're looking back on it, we can say that. But, yeah, I remember Funland. You were just like, man, I thought it'd be better. Like, there was a clown with a machine gun on the cover. Like, how could that movie suck? Like, what the fuck?
Okay.
Then, Rage War, obviously.
Oh, it's always going to be the Dungeon Master to me, but this is such a great bad movie that it got released on DVD recently through Shout Factory, but they put it on one of their releases where it's like that and three other Charles Band produced movies. But it kind of deserves its own recognition because it's like such a weird put together movie. It was like eight different directors with eight different short films, and they're all stitched together through this random narrative of like a evil wizard sending this guy on a series of challenges to rescue his girlfriend. And it's just kind of like a jam. It's like a Charles Band Empire Pictures jam band session or something. Cause you've got like John Carl Beichler and Charles Band and I'm trying to think of the director of like Terror Vision. And it's like all these guys who, if you've seen those movies from that era, you might recognize them. And they're all just like making, you know, it's a Road Warrior knockoff followed by a weird horror movie followed by a weird serial killer movie. Anyways, I'm going on, but the Dungeon Master, aka Rage War. What can you say? Listen to the episode, and you'll hear us go on about it. It was like, you know, we were both, I think, pleasantly surprised by how amusingly weird it was. And then they shoot horses, don't they? This is I don't know why I wanted to check out They Shoot Horses,
I'm really glad you did because
but
I'd never.
What an unacknowledged great movie from 1969. It's a lot like the movie version of The Day of the Locust, which came out, you know, almost 10 years later. Or not really. It came out like 6 years later, 75. But what it has in common with Day of the Locust is that, like, They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Is also based on a novel from like the 1930s, which is just about the death of the American dream or how the American dream is all enmeshed in the need for fame and celebrity, and it's just incredibly bleak and kind of grimly hilarious, and it's a great movie. And
what's a little distressing is that you told me to see that. I believe at the time we watched They Shoot Horses, Don't They? And that was now 4 years ago. Day of the Locust, I mean. So that has been on my watch list for 4 years now.
Oh, okay. Well,
but yeah. But no, yeah. They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Is an awesome movie. And I think that that was the one that's with Michael Sarrazin as the male lead. And yeah, that's actually a really good episode because we were still kind of figuring things out and we were both really excited about it. I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were just young and dumb and full of cum then. Jim Cotta, speaking of full of cum, this is a movie about the pommel horse and all the exciting action sequences you can shoot around a pommel horse.
Now, you know this is on DVD now, right?
Yeah, it's a Canon movie, I think.
Yeah,
maybe.
I think it's out from...
Or Golden Globus. It's like, hey, let's hire an Olympic athlete and shoot an action movie around what he won a medal for. That's pretty much all there is to it. And we watched It's a Gift. So we watched two W.C. Fields movies in the history of an Alan Smithy podcast. And, you know, it's W.C. Fields. It's awesome. What can you say? Prior to that, and this was the first of our double feature episodes, we watched Mannequin, the first one, and Terminator 2. And I don't remember.
There was a reason for that, and I believe it was because I was convinced that Entertainment Weekly did like a dual review of Terminator 2 and Mannequin 2, saying that it had something to do with like they were both video hits or something. And I don't think we were ever sure that I was right in my memory of a, you know, at that point, 20 or 18 year old magazine article. But yeah, that was our first one. That was our reinvention, and that came about 4 months after the last episode, and that's when we decided we were going to do one good movie, one bad movie.
Right.
Or no, because, is that even what we called it? Yeah.
Because prior to that, we did three – I think each of them were two-parters, but they each had kind of were just – topic discussion. We did one on Korean. We did one on South Korean movies because we had both, you know, been watching some of them recently. We did one on the filmography of Quentin Tarantino, which up to this point would have just been up until Death Proof. And we did one on John Carpenter. And I'm still fond of the title I came up with for that one.
Our Carpenter, first episode.
Carpenter was a Jesus.
Yeah.
Get it.
Yeah, that was cool. And these episodes are like 4 hours combined. I mean, I think that Dark Knight episode was like 6 hours.
Oh yeah,
like,
and somewhere in there we did the Dark Knight.
Yeah,
yeah. Just talking about our hatred of it.
It was at least 3 hours. So who knows how? And what's funny is I'm looking at it right now, and we did it with a quote from Robert Downey Jr., who of course then went on to make Iron Man, had made Iron Man just previous to that. But
and he was talking about why Iron Man was superior to Dark Knight,
or something. Yeah, he didn't understand Dark Knight, but of course then he said he loved The Prestige, which I subsequently saw, and I fucking hate that movie. But yeah, we didn't really know what we were doing at the beginning, and I guess in that point it was more like what. Because you don't really know, because I'm looking at our description for episode 10, which was, we're giving birth to the son of the Alan Smithy podcast, and we're going to do different things. And we didn't really do that, because we hadn't really figured it out yet.
Yeah.
Because it was because we were trying to do little topics. It was just like little stuff that we had come up with to talk about.
Right,
as opposed to actual movies. And I mean, it's rough, and I think that you can see that now with most movie podcasts discuss.
They've gotten like lasering it down to just one particular theme, you
right.
know, to a science. I mean, whatever. I kind of envy, you know, how did this get made, or you know, stuff like that, because that's just figuring out the right topic to. But I mean, here's what I think, or here's what I've observed. Most movie podcasts are about bad movies because it's easier to go on at length about what's wrong with a bad movie than it is to just praise a good movie for any spate of time.
That's true, but I feel like, take for example our Escape from New York episode. I think that was the first time that when I watched it for that episode, that I really thought about the sound in that movie and how the music was mixed in. And so, you know, in some ways, the bad movie thing is probably better for ratings, but the good movie thing, you know.
Better for us?
Well, better for us, but it's not even really commercialization, because I don't think these guys who are doing it now they can't sell them. They're not selling a lot of advertising from what I've heard on the movie podcasts I've heard. So it's just like it's an ego boost. And
yeah, it's self-promotion.
It's self-promotion. I mean, there are some really funny ones. I listened to some movie podcast with, I don't know if it was Doug Loves Movies or it was something, but Adam Scott and Chris Evans were on there right after the Avengers came out. And it was Chris Evans getting drunk talking shit about the Avengers. And I mean, I was like... We couldn't have done that. That's pretty cool. But I'm also not a stand-up comic who knows these people, you know? So,
Right.
Yeah, and I mean, the horror movie thing, as far as podcasts go, has sort of...
Well, yeah.
Well, I just think that's sort of... It was there, kind of went away for a second. Now it's back as sort of the emphasis for the amateur hobbyist podcast is you... You find a horror niche and you do a podcast on it.
Oh yeah, well look, because I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to do a podcast, you know, when you asked me to, was I had been a big fan of this horror movie podcast called Dead Pit. You can visit them at deadpit.com. These guys actually got into the game before podcasts were a thing. And they did – it's two guys from Eastern Kentucky, and they've done it – they did it really well. And they actually, like, got a lot of guests. And I think they managed to get a lot of, like, real-name guests, like directors and stuff, because doing podcast interviews at the time was still kind of a novelty.
Right.
And I'm talking about before we were doing Alan Smithy. I'm talking about, like, 2007, 2006 around
right.
then is when they started. And they fucking churned them out, man. And they did it really well. And they did so many of them that they got to the point where one of them, you know, had a kid and just didn't really want to do it anymore. So now they just kind of do them occasionally, only it's with, you know, not the original two hosts. It's one of them and then a buddy of theirs, like, kind of filling in. And they don't get, you know, they don't get interviews anymore, but it kind of doesn't matter. Like, they've got this great body of work just as far as podcasting. And I don't know, I think, you know, with all the stuff we did, we should go back and cut some of it together, you know, for like the best of, cause,
yeah.
You know, here and there, there's stuff kind of that'll be worth listening to down the line. Oh, and as far as horror podcasts go, yeah, I mean, even within the genre of the horror movies, I mean, there's a good, very good horror website called Hysteria Lives. It's a British site. It's like hysteria-lives.co.uk. They've got their own podcast, but you know, it's entirely slasher movies. Like, it's just a horror website about slasher movies, just rating them and stuff and reviewing them. And they've got their own podcast of just slasher movie reviews, and they've got, you know, interviews with some people who have worked on slasher movies and stuff. So, yeah, once again, we never found our niche, Andrew. We never found our niche.
No, we never really did. I mean, it's like looking over our list, it's like, we could have just done crappy movies from, I don't know, the late 80s. Like, not studio
yeah.
movies, but crappy indie movies from the late
80s.
But
how do you come up with a catchy name for the crappy
you
indie
really can't.
Movies from the late 80s podcast?
There really isn't one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
Still, though, I mean, you know, people could say that we've had a bad break, like kind of never really finding what Alan Smithy podcast was supposed to be about beyond just us talking about movies two at a time, whatever we felt like. But today, I consider myself, the luckiest man, on the face of the earth.
Okay, now I'm turning red, but okay.
Also, I have Lou Gehrig's disease. I didn't want
We never did Pride of the Yankees. What were we thinking? We really should have listed all the things we later went, wait, why didn't we just do that? Yeah, because there have been a lot of those.
Can we coin Alan Smithy podcast's disease as like when you don't know what your podcast is supposed to be and you just let it ramble on for 6 years?
At work. I think that's an Alan Smithy disease, kind of, isn't it? Yeah. Esther House disease. I think we started talking about doing what the hell was the Walter Hill sci-fi movie that they had to get a new pseudonym for? Do you remember what I'm talking about with Angela Bassett and James Spader? It's gonna take me 2 seconds here. Here we go. Supernova, when they had to come up with a different pseudonym. We talked about doing that for years. And we never did it. Yeah. We could have paired that with something like Sunshine real easy. I think, you know, in some ways, I think what made the podcast really interesting is it did start out as a clash of sort of film interests. And that's why it's not going to find a niche, is because it is a clash, even though that's what made it more interesting than not.
This has not been so much a movie podcast as a character study of two movie fans.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean,
I should kill someone and then, you know, the cops can just, you know, go like somebody who wants to write a book can just listen to every episode and profile me.
Not until I set it up to you have to buy every episode. Wait, hold on. Hold off on that idea. A lot of things. We never really talked a lot about the blogging aspect of it either.
No, we would just plug our blogs at the
We'd
very
plug
end.
It. But yeah, I mean, it's just kind of like it's changed a lot. Back when we started, I approached Matt to do a podcast because he was the guy who was writing about the things that were interesting at the time in 2000 and probably 2007 and 2008. And you found Stop Button through MRQE and John Carpenter Reviews,
right?
And then we started reading each other.
Yeah, I actually
other.
I knew who you were before you had contacted
yeah,
me, so I was just over the moon, you know.
And I started reading Cine Machine, and you were in college at that point, and so yeah, and we just were like, hey, let's just do this podcast, because why not? We both like John Carpenter and think Quentin Tarantino's overrated and fuck The Dark Knight, so we can do a podcast. And, it took us a while to realize, hey, maybe we should come up with a better idea than just that.
People think it's so weird when I explain that I've known you for 6 years and I've never met you.
I know. I know that. Yeah, exactly. Because I've started doing a podcast with someone I've known for. I do my comics podcast, and I guess I've known the guy I do the podcast that for maybe 10 years, I guess, maybe. And so, but we actually were, we're friends, and I was just listening on that Matt Geekab podcast where it was like, they're like, why did we do a podcast? Oh, it's because we, you know, don't live near each other. So we talk every once in a while and we're like, hey, this is actually interesting. We should turn it into a podcast. And it's like, that's kind of my comics podcast thing. Cause I'm the comics reviewing guy who does a bunch of stuff. He does a comics retail thing, but yeah, we've never met each other.
Yeah, I think I was that is, in, that's the Comics Fondle podcast,
that's
by the
Comics
way,
Fondle
comicsfondle.com.
Yeah, but yeah, so us never having met each other, I was talking to somebody about finishing off the podcast, I'm like, you know, it's really weird. We've been doing this forever, and I've really enjoyed it, and it's like, I've never met Matt. It's really weird.
Yeah. Well, I mean, God, when I think back of, like, trying to build a rapport at the time, I mean, we had barely – that's the thing. We had barely even talked, like,
we didn't do a pilot. We didn't do an ash can of the thing. The first episode would have just been the first time we ever hit record, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And before that, it was like emails were, hey, do you want to do a podcast? And I was like, sure. And yeah. Then, you know, the back and forth of trying to figure out a name. But then it was just like, yeah. And then I assume that we did really, really long podcasts and split them up. So I think by the time we hit. Well, that's like eight, that's 7 months, I would say, before we started doing the pairings. So, yeah, we spent about 7 months building a rapport. And you're not going to – that was very indicative, I think, at the time for podcasts, that it was sort of a creation of, you know, the internet, whereas now it's –
Yeah. And then something else, too, about just Skyping is that, like – you know, I think we've done all right, but a podcast that you do on Skype is never going to be as good as if you're in the same room with
right.
the other guy.
Yeah.
Because there's just natural conversational dynamics that'll happen if you can see each other.
Especially for the commentaries, I feel
oh,
like.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Those were cumbersome to work out on a technical level. But, you know, all the podcasts that we were mentioning, you know, the ones that have kind of taken off and are, you know, done by professional comics – those are all two guys in a room looking at each other, riffing with each other kind of thing. So it's closer to like Howard Stern or Opie and Anthony in terms
right.
of just having a good natural energy and flow. But I mean, heck, we did it long. We did this long enough that we learned to anticipate each other's rhythms and stuff and give each other time to talk.
I think a good bounty. And I guess you'd have to leave a comment either on, well, probably the website. Cause I don't check the iTunes comments anymore. would be, I remember there was one episode where it was toward the beginning. And I think it was a pairing and I was falling asleep. And you commented on it after we were done.
I do not remember what episode.
I don't either, but you were like, hey, thanks for, you know, you were like, hey, I could tell you were getting tired. Thanks for sticking it out. So that's the bounty. If you can figure out what episode that was, dear listener, you're free. Your prize. Wait, crap. How many listeners do we have? Because I just.
Oh, probably 16 at least by now.
Okay, so if we have 16 listeners and they have to go back through, am I safe with offering? I'm actually offering as a bounty prize, Trancers City of Lost Angels, which
Whoa.
I just, what's up? I just discovered it's out on DVD. That's the short movie sequel to Trancers that they did as like a promo that Paramount never released. And this is really old Alan Smithy stuff. I was inspired by Rage War and Dungeon Master that, you know, Full Moon used to have to, you know, bend over backwards to impress Paramount Home Video. And so they did a bunch of short movies and Charles Band released it. So yeah, if you can figure out the episode where I was falling asleep and Matt was carrying the episode, you will get yourself a free copy of Trancers City of Lost Angels on DVD, starring Academy Award winner Helen Hunt.
Rockin'.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, we, well, I mean, another big thing was we figured out how to do a time limit. Because
right.
before that, we were just like, bah.
Yeah, we've cut it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've cut, yeah. We don't have work to go tomorrow to go to tomorrow. Who cares? Yeah, and then we got it to be about a half an hour per good movie, half an hour per bad movie.
Yeah.
But even that, we run over, but who cares? It's just that an hour is about an ideal length for a podcast. Funny how they've been called podcasts despite the fact that nobody's listening to them on their iPods anymore. Or maybe they are. In any case, Apple probably wishes they had trademarked that. Maybe they have.
Or figured out how to monetize it.
How to monetize it, exactly.
Yeah.
All right. So Should we start wrapping this thing up forever? forever now. You know, cinemachine.blogspot.com is still up and running. I'm planning to relocate my film writing to matthewhurwitz.com, as I mentioned earlier, and just start writing again because I've really, you know, been away from it for a while. And it's not for lack of ideas. It really isn't. It's just for lack of time. I'm also doing a lot of cartooning these days, and you can check out my comics and cartoon strips on sissylaughs.com. That's SissyLaffs, sissylaughs.com. And you know, speaking of comics, I mean, we've mentioned Comics Fondle. I enjoy Comics Fondle just as much as I enjoy the stopbutton.com.
Yeah, I've really tried in the last year and a half to really turn comicsfondle.com into, I don't know if I mentioned this on an episode, but I think I mentioned it to you once in a pre-show, was just that with the Comics Fondle, there's a lot less of a time commitment into reading the, digesting the material. And so you can kind of control what it is a lot easier than a movie blog where your time commitment's a lot different. And so, yeah, Comics Fondle.
Has its own podcast with your buddy Vernon Wiley.
Vernon Wiley.
He's a retailer, you're a reader. It's a great dynamic, and you can focus more on that podcast now.
He can't figure out Skype.
stopbutton.com though, still going strong, still updated almost every, you know, Monday through Friday, and I still highly enjoy that. You're a great movie blogger, and I hope you keep doing that for the rest of your days.
Yeah.
But Alan Smithy podcast, it's been a good run. It's been a fun run. Anybody out there who stuck with us for any duration of time, if you're listening to this now, thanks.
We hope you enjoy
it.
And I will say that if you are out there listening and you did record some like asinine comment about us, there'd be an episode 101 of that. I'm just throwing that out there. But I'd put in the work to edit together some. I don't know. I don't think we have the personalities for that. Like impressions of us. I don't know.
You know.
I think
it would be going in monotone, in a low pitched monotone.
Wait, hold on. If you can string together.
Oh, boy.
Oh, here we go. If you can string together a theory of cinema that includes John Carpenter, RoboCop, what else? Mad Max. Even though we never watched a Mad Max, what else could we throw in here that you would have to string in?
The Dark Knight.
Dark Knight sucking. Not, you can't like it. Yeah. You have to hate it. South Korean movies.
Comic book movies. Warner Brothers comedy sequels.
Paul Verhoeven.
Chevy Chase.
If you could string together some rant on that, yeah, that'd be an episode one. I'd throw together a special commemorative of that. But, yeah, so I think that's another way of saying thank you for being a listener, because I do know that there are listeners out there. It's just not really enough to support me.
Yeah.
Which isn't the listener's fault, of course. It's just,
you know, no, it's our fault.
It's our fault for not being stand-up comics or I don't know what.
Not lazy, I guess.
Yeah.
Or having jobs, you know.
Jobs, blogging, and podcasting, none of those things really go together.
Right.
In some ways, blogging and podcasting doesn't really go together, and jobs in either of the two.
Or just other interests in general, loved ones.
Yeah.
Oh, heck. All right, look at us making excuses at the bitter end.
On the other hand, I always did want to do an episode of significant others having to suffer through some movie we both loved that they hated. I thought that would have been fun. I don't know if I told you this, but I think it was last summer, my wife and her friend wanted to do podcast commentaries of the original Star Trek episodes. And I was like, and she was like, will you help me figure out how to record it? And I was like, yeah, but I'm going to be a little pissed off because more people are going to listen to that to do to my podcast. Cause like girls talking about geek shit, like that's the new thing. Like I'm going to be pissed off about this.
Yeah.
She didn't do it. So at least, well, on the other hand, I probably haven't sold, she could have sold off the brand, but yeah.
Let's pretend to be girls and do a Geek Girls podcast where we talk about our favorite geeky movies and or girls. All right, let's not.
Well, I don't know. Could GarageBand change our voices? I don't think it can. Yeah.
Let's go back through every episode and modulate our voices to a higher pitch. And remove all the misogyny so that nobody can tell.
What was the misogyny episode? Do you remember that one? It was relatively recent.
It's called Every Episode Was the Misogyny Episode. And so, this is another reason we could never go mainstream.
Yeah, I think so. A little bit. Okay.
Right. Anything else? Forever.
No, I think we took it from like some nice gradual reminiscence. Now we're just like
this started out like Johnny Carson giving his farewell speech, and it just turned into Lenny Bruce reading his court transcripts.
See, we should have done Lenny. We should have done Lenny and Gia.
Yeah, and the Lenny Bruce performance film. Right?
What the hell were we thinking? Because you know how many people out there
like Tears in the Rain, Time to Die.
I think I'm going to change the Alan Smithy logo to a dove flying right now.
Yeah, in the opening shots of The Shining.
Okay, so anyway, yeah, so go check out sissylaughs.com because he's not going to say it, but his cartoons are really funny and... he did a Baby Judge Dredd thing. I don't know if you've done that again, but that was freaking awesome. I was showing that to everybody. So,
yeah, I need to do more of those. Yeah. And check out Andrew's comics blog. It's great. Comicsfondle.com. And keep reading thestopbutton.com. And I know I haven't updated Cine Machine in forever, but pretty soon check out MatthewHurwitz.com. That's MatthewHurwitz. I'm moving all my film blogging over there and getting serious about it again. And I've got a lot of articles, a lot of essays to write, a lot of interviews to conduct. So it's going to be good stuff. But as far as an Alan Smithy podcast, that about does it.
Yeah, we're done. And thank you for sticking with this really long episode. I don't even want to tell you how many times we've had to stop and start thanks to Skype.
Yeah, but... all right, that's it.
Yeah,
so,
that's it.
For an Alan Smithy podcast, and I'm doing my Johnny Carson right now, we bid you all a very heartfelt thanks for listening.
I will remember you. Will you remember me? Don't let your love
Honey, wake up. You won't believe the dream I just had.